Okay, I think we can start right now because it's like kitchen starting, but I think the slides are still not on the web as of yet. It will be there soon, but we should go ahead in the interest of time. It's my pleasure to introduce Keith Marzullo. Keith, again, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Keith is currently the Division Director of the Computer and Network Systems Division in SAISI, in NSF, the National Science Foundation. Prior to that, he was a professor at the University of California, San Diego. Actually, the interesting fact is that I think about almost three decades ago, Keith was working on something called clock synchronization, if I'm right. Yeah. That's so appropriate for the Internet of Things. Again, Keith, you must be kind of looking at it and say, "Ooh, you know, I even done this about three decades ago." People are looking back at it, and that validates the kind of and vindicates the work that you have been doing all this time. Thank you again, Keith. Keith is going to talk about cyber-physical systems and Internet of Things. Okay?
Let's see. I guess I'll stand here. If I wander around, then maybe I could have that microphone.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
I'll leave it to you. Perfect. That's what we'll do. Yeah, that'll be fine. Anyway, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I can't believe it was 30 years ago I did my dissertation on clock synchronization. That's always a rude thing to be reminded of when you start. What I'm going to do today is tell you a bit about a program we have in SAISI, in my division, called the Cyber-Physical Systems. It's actually a large program for about 7 years. I'm going to get wired up here. I can wander around.
Oh, look at that. It's a death knot.
Just knock out the neck. Oh, that's all my. Look at that. We're going to get in just a second here. Hang on.
How do you tie a knot like that? How's that?
Yep, it's pretty good.
Is that okay? Okay, good. This is a program that's going for about 7 years, and I'm going to put it in the context of IoT. These terms, Internet of Things, Industrial Internet, Cyber-Physical Systems, Wireless Sensor Networks, you folks do ontologies, you know that terms matter, but all these terms sort of overlap each other. I'm going to try to sort that out in the context of the programs that we do. Beep? That's why. I'm going to start with this picture. This was actually done for a conference we have called CPS Week that's been going on for a while. CPS Week is indeed going on right now in Seattle. This is meant to have you start thinking about what the future will be like. Imagine a world. The funny thing is that since the time we did this, many of these things are now realities. We're already seeing things in safe highways, smart cars, energy-efficient power grid. This looks remarkably like the Intelligence River project that's going on at Clemson, assistive medical devices, structurally sound bridges. This future is really here. Some of the things that we had in this idea of imagine the future was, well, imagine a future when static infrastructure like bridges is adaptable and safe. We're now doing this kind of things, being able to instrument bridges, to use the ambient traffic that's driving across them to be able to tell if they're structurally sound, or scheduling when loads have to be brought across them to be able to understand their structural integrity. Imagine a day where you can forecast and mitigate ecological change. I mentioned this project called the Intelligent Rivers Project. This is one run out of Clemson where they have instrumented the Suwannee River Basin, collecting information not only of the water and the chemical properties of the water and the flow properties of the water, but also the vegetation surrounding it. Then using that in cellular technology to send this up to a local high-performance computing center to be able to give you minute-by-minute monitoring of what's going on in the area. This is a way to understand if there's a point pollution source in the Suwannee Basin, you can quickly identify what its impact is and perhaps be able to mitigate it quickly. Health and well-being. This is something I suppose it really started with, well, Deb Estrin, who's now Cornell Tech, really started the field of mHealth, but it's gone much farther than that. Our ability to instrument what's going on with us in terms of all things going on. I have no idea where she's running. This is just a great picture. It looks like the Donovan Salt Flats. Where you can monitor a variety of information, what's going on, which can then be sent to hospitals or your doctors to be able to understand what's going on with you. Larry Smarr at UCSD, my own home institution, has taken this to the extreme level, to monitor exactly what's going on in his blood chemistry several times a day. So he was able to diagnose Crohn's disease 9 months before it became clinically observable. This kind of ability to collect information, combine it with other people, big data, small data sometimes, but a lot of information just on you, is changing the way that we're doing healthcare. Smart grids. I don't know why you think the smart grid is just a great picture with all the lights, but certainly there's a lot of work that's going on in terms of understanding what are the demands of energy, and then being able to match those demands with power generation. GE, for example, has created a new consortium called the Industrial Internet Consortium. Then one of the projects they talk about, a pilot project, is being able to look at the data that is on the energy that's being consumed and have that be able to interact with alternate power sources, say wind turbines, to be able to schedule demand better. Energy response, our ability to be able to respond to disasters by using robots. This is one of these robots. I love the name Survivor Buddy, but there are other kinds of robots as well that have been developed, such as robots that are like snakes. Other robots is a marsupial one. It goes into a point until a smaller robot can come out of its pouch and move in farther. That was actually used not that long ago in a major disaster. This ability to be able to go in and get information on the ground, what's going on, without risking human life is a wonderful thing. In the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, for example, in Japan, we had several of our projects go out and actually try out their techniques. Transportation, safety, and in energy. We all like to think of a day when traffic fatalities no longer exist. Of course, cars have gotten much safer now, but we can do much more. Indeed, there are a lot of projects that are going on in terms of autonomous vehicles. One of the ones we've been studying at NSF is that out of Carnegie Mellon. I don't know if you heard about this. I think it was about a year ago. They had the car up here, and they took Congress people out for a drive. It was actually pretty cool. You put them on the car, and the car jumped on the beltway, went out around the Pentagon, and came back. It was actually very nice. And the senators or the congressmen who are in this, congresspeople are in this, reported that they, by the time they crossed the Roosevelt Island, they stopped being afraid. I had a chance to take a ride in this car as well at Carnegie Mellon, and I thought I was doing great. But, of course, a car can drive backwards just as well as forwards, right? There's no difference to the car. And I felt very comfortable until the car was doing 35 miles an hour backwards. And the driver was looking at me because there is no driver. There's a guy in the driver's seat saying, this is pretty cool. Look what we're doing now. So there is going to be a learning curve in this stuff, but we're getting there. We're making tremendous progress. So I may, yeah, we can also talk about the worries of where it's going. I'll come back to that. There's plenty of things to worry about. So all these projects are what we call cyber-physical system projects. They're funded out of our CPS program. And so I want to touch briefly on the terminology we use here. Cyber-physical systems, Internet of Things, or Internet of Everything, or Industrial Internet, wireless sensor networks. We have spent amazing amount of time arguing amongst ourselves what we should name this, what should we be doing, how should we brand what we're trying to do. Certainly the Office of Science Technology Policy a few years ago really asked us to try to come up with a much better name than cyber-physical systems because, frankly, that's not a name that brings music to your heart. And we finally pretty much gave up and realized that these are terms and they share so many core technologies that each one is basically focusing on a certain set of issues. But instead of trying to decide what the differences are, it's good to understand what the commonalities are. What are the common problems that we're trying to solve? Certain of the things that are driving all of these systems are open programmable devices and objects. We know that the number of devices are rapidly increasing. There's an estimate that by the end of the decade, there will be 70% of the homes will have IoT devices in them. How many have IoT devices in your home right now? Is that all? Wow. Is it a smart light bulb?
Smart video camera.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Irrigation.
Yeah, that's actually a really good application. Right. All I have is the smart Fitbit thing with the scale, so when I step on the scale and it weighs me, it updates my web page, which has privacy concerns. I don't know how protective that is. But that's a very simple application using Wi-Fi. But I'm going to talk about a few more. We're obviously going to see a lot more of these. Right now, I still think we're in the irrigation is a great application. The camera is a good one. We're still much in the toy, like what mine is doing, but that's going to change rapidly. There's a lot going on in terms of industry standards. This is necessary to make this all work. Two weeks ago, I was at a workshop with the European Union and with Japan. It was a small workshop. Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt, but the thing about the households having these devices brought up a question in my mind. When you talk about a cyber-physical device, it doesn't necessarily have to be connected to an internet or a network of other things, does it?
When I think of cyber-physical systems, communication is an integral part of the system.
Communications with what? Outside itself?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the compositionality, for example, is a large problem.
Because one of the things that came to my mind is many of the HVA systems that they put in houses today have lots of microprocessors in them, and maybe even the temperature sensors, if there's many of them, have sensors and they're communicating among each other. So I didn't start counting. But there's sort of a closed system or a closed network.
Right, right. So we certainly have thought of CPS that are more closed. I mean, for example, a car has, of course, hundreds of processors in it. And they all communicate with each other in a system of systems approach. When you start thinking of the IoT, when you think of some of the problems that are coming up, the openness is going to be an issue. So,
in fact, our definition that we have done, we have come up with, IoT is just all the devices connected on the internet. And then you give some control and decision making over it, you have CPS. Depending on whom you talk to, some people claim that everything is. IoT is a subclass of CPS.
Turn your mic on.
Sorry?
Turn your mic on.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
IoT is a subset of CPS. I'm going to have a slide that talks about that. Someone's on the phone?
Yes. The comment is that GE, Intel, Healthcare have a elderly people's home which is having all types of sensors in it. None of them are invasive to the patient. So how do you classify that category?
I love talking to ontologists. When you say not invasive, what do you mean by that? You mean
they are watching the people and their behavior, but they are not intruding with any mounted sensors on their physical body. For example, they watch your eye movement. They watch how often you how would you classify such an environment?
From my CPS point of view, I classify that as fundable. That is something that we would actually consider. In fact, we have put some research money into that. And so I would consider that a cyber physical system, especially if there's a control aspect. I don't know where that feedback is coming from. I'm the only one who can talk? Okay, very good. So anyway, this is the end of the slide, just to finish. As you know, there's a tremendous amount of hype associated with the Internet of Things. And much of that is because everyone smells markets. They smell money. They smell this is a way that we're going to be able to commercialize. And so part of the problem you have in defining IoT is on the basis that everyone wants to define it for themselves. But it's clear that there are already lots of development going on in applications, interest in devices. The general belief is all the money that will be made will be done on the analytics side and on the application side, that the devices are going to be loss leaders. But there's tremendous problems that we're going to have to solve in doing that. I'll get to that as we go on. So when you think about CPS in relation to IoT, I'm going to do this two different ways. In cyber-physical systems, we deal with this big scope system. So we worry about things like autonomous vehicles, cars, airplanes, which have hundreds of network processors, sensors, and actuators integrating with the real world in physical time. And so that integration, that control, I can see where that's what you wanted to latch on to say, or you're thinking of for cyber-physical systems. The notion of control comes into this. The human is definitely in the loop or on the loop. They are part of the system and have to be designed as an integral way for it. There are lots of disasters that you can point to when this has not been done. And so humans are an important part of this. There are issues of integration and composition, these systems that we're building. So when you talk about a home just by itself, we don't tend to think of that as much because we think the system is going to have to integrate with other systems. It's going to become part of a larger ecosystem. And understanding how to do that is an important thing that we see in our CPS program. Now, IoT, in some sense, has a lot in common. If you think about what people say in IoT, the scale is enormous. If you're talking about billions of devices, that is well beyond any scale that we've talked about in CPS. Of course, we're going to get there by agglutination, but the composition is going to be an issue. The other issue I also worry about, I'll come back and touch on this, is that CPS has really grown out of safe system design. So there's a lot of socio-technical issues that we worry about, privacy, security, safety, certifiability. All these issues are important. And my worry that many of the things that are going to happen in CPS, I'm sorry, in IoT, Internet of Things, are not going to necessarily have that same level of safety, security. And as you all know, that risk is undervalued until something happens, in which case it is overvalued. I imagine that there will be issues where we'll build these systems, we'll be making a lot of progress, and then disaster things will happen, and we'll have to recover. And I can make this prediction because this is the way we always do things. We have done this time and time again. So this is the other way I like to talk about CPS, putting IoT in this. So the idea here is CPS, in my mind, has four main drivers, cyber-physical systems, at least as seen from NSF. The first one is what I've been calling Internet of Things. And this is being really, really driven by the sensor side of things, the low-cost sensors, low-power sensors, the growth in 5G communication, MEMS, and so on. And this is providing a lot of opportunities to be able to think about the way we're building these cyber-physical systems. The second part are national priorities, things that we are trying to solve because we have to solve. Energy, healthcare, advanced manufacturing, education, disaster recovery, all these things we are being asked to address from the federal government. They are national priorities, and CPS has a role in this. The third one is science and technology advances. There's much that's going on that's affecting the way we're doing CPS. Machine learning, data analytics, big data, all important parts that are driving the way we're doing our program, as well as advances in control. Control theory, if you look at some of the projects we're doing, combined learning-based control and physical-based control. There's a lot that we're doing in this space. There's all the issues of them being socio-technical systems, work in advanced materials. There's much that's going on that's in the S&T side that's driving our CPS program. And finally, there's a lot going on in the industrial side of things. The commercialization, monetization, development of standards, consortia, going back to the II Industrial Internet Consortium, which was just set up a little over a year ago. It started off with four or five companies, I believe. It was a small number of companies, and last I knew, it was reaching 100 companies in a period of 1 year.
In fact, our first keynote speaker is one of the senior vice president of IIT.
Joe Salvo? No.
Swami
Shaman? Oh, yeah, Shaman Datta from MIT. Yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah, so you know all about what's going on in this.
The morning he talked about.
Yeah, so you know the tremendous growth in that area. And that's just one consortium in the area. So there's much that's driving what's making our CPS program the way it is today. I also like to show this. You all know about Gartner Hype Cycles. This is always fun to look at because the terms are so wonderful. You have the innovation trigger to peak of inflated expectations, to trough of disillusionment, to slope of enlightenment, to plateau of productivity. And when you think about this, of course, you think that when it's up here, then all it's going to do is go down. But, of course, this really talks about a maturity. What are the level that people are talking about? So a peak of inflated expectations means that people are promising the world in this. So if you think about what's going on in a totally different context in program obfuscation, which is seem to be a promising way of thinking about increasing security, that's like right up here. We're promising way, way more than it's ever going to do. And then, of course, historically, as you learn what's going on, it finally matures out to where you have something that is a stable technology. The way to look at this is that the colors and shapes of the dots indicate how long it'll be that Gartner predicts until it reaches that plateau of productivity. And They have some that are obsolete for Plateau, which I love. I don't see any here. This is, by the way, from just last fall. And the ones that see Internet of Things is right at the top. That's nowhere to go but down at this point, right? We're basically maximized our ability to talk about what a wonderful thing it's going to be. Autonomous vehicles are near the top, of course. We're all hearing about that now, the wonderful things autonomous vehicles will be doing. Smart robots are just on their way up, the robots that are codependents, things that will work with us, and so on. We have a long ways to go until we overpromise that, but we're getting there. Connected homes are relatively new from last year. I think by now it's up to here. It's moving fast. Smart workspaces, you're just starting to hear about more. And then getting to the other things, mobile health monitoring. This is almost all the way down to the bottom where we're now under-promising what it will do. But there are plenty of applications that will move this out. Machine-to-machine communication, a major aspect of the IoT, is already down here as well. And the interesting thing is they're all the same shade dot. They're all supposed to reach plateau in 5 to 10 years. So I'll let you think about that. I think there's more that's going to be coming out of this, too. We'll see new things that are coming on the edge. But this is a good way to think about the terminology. I've got to say Internet of Things is one of those things that you're already hearing things like Internet of Broken Things.
Is there a place for semantics in there? I'm not sure I see everything.
This is just technology. This is just technology. They have other curves for other things as well.
Machine learning would be semantic technology.
Yeah, I see your point. I don't think machine learning is on here. Well, data sciences, look at that.
Big data.
Yeah. Software-defined anything? No.
The problem here is that the mixed technologies and systems, kind of thing, like, for example, robots, big data is a process, an outcome of all this.
So they do have many curves, and I recommend you actually. Gartner's very good at making these available. This is how they get their press.
So I'm curious about the selections that have been highlighted in red, and specifically what differentiates quantified self from, you know, things like personal mobile health monitoring.
Do you see quantified self here?
In the middle, right next to connected home.
Quantified self, yeah. So when I see that phrase, I honestly can't say what that is. When I see that phrase, I think of my colleague, Larry Smarr, and where he's going through and doing. And he was the one who famously said he's the first person to actually do medicine from a scientific point of view. His point is that he's be able to get the detail of information about himself at such a fine grain that he can look at himself as a system and be able to make fine grain measurements and changes, sort of the small data. Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's an IT technician here, and he wants to know how many people who are not connected would like to get connected.
One. Okay. So here's just a quick picture of some of the things you can get right now in a smart connected home. I'm sure you've seen all of these. And you know the function of thermostat is, of course, one that's famously available because it's been used as a vector for cyber attack. Yale Lock now has a smart lock that allows you to lock and unlock things remotely, all digital. The Hue bulb allows you to control off an application on your phone, up to 50 or so of these bulbs, so you can change the lighting as well as the color. I don't view that as a critical application myself, but maybe I'm too old. Outlets for outlet control. Sonos looks pretty nice. It's a way to be able to set up a stereo system that you can control. Everything is being sent wirelessly. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've been thinking some LED seminars, and there's a new system where you can walk in and the lights open.
Yeah, I've been taking some LED seminars. I'm an architect, and they're having LED systems now that you can walk into a space, and depending on your mood, the colors change. So there's an incredible interactive environment that's being developed with that technology and sensors.
Fantastic. I think it's going to be amazing. I do want to point out that one of the issues here is interconnection. How do you make these all work from different vendors? the Revolve Hub was the solution to that. It's already gone bankrupt. You can't get Revolve Hubs anymore. I think they were bought out by someone else. So still the interconnectivity issue is a huge problem in terms of even now in the early days.
Question?
Yes.
You said interconnectivity. Is that interconnectivity? Is that Ethernet or is that some higher level? Is that semantic interconnectivity?
I believe Revolve is trying to do it at a higher level. Exactly what level, I don't know. I think they're just trying to be able to take the various high-level protocols that you use to communicate with these devices and come up with a common platform. My feeling is, having talked with the European Union, the level we're at right now is sort of like what we were in the 1980s with the Internet, right? We're basically at the same level of remote procedure call, trying to figure out how to get a common language for these to talk. We're well far away from things like SOAP or object-oriented programming.
The scary thing in all of that is the lock. Just how secure? I mean, surely a hacker could open it up with, like, using one finger or something.
I don't have a lock on my door like that, so I can't tell you. I don't know.
The override is a sledgehammer.
Social engineering. Yeah, so I share your worry about the security of all these systems. I mean, just to have a brief swerve on this, the general problem I've seen in these, we've all seen on this, is the engineers who design the system tend to have a set of assumptions that don't necessarily hold, right? And so they are then surprised because they haven't built in the security you'd normally expect for these systems because they felt the attack surface didn't exist. So a good example of this is Stefan Savage when he showed this is what he did with the OnStar system. Do you know about this work? So he showed some years ago, this is like maybe 4 years ago, that you can attack OnStar cars and be able to do things like lock the brakes, deploy the airbag, things like that. It's all fairly scary. The president's car had OnStar, and so these things had to be fixed. And the reason why these attacks could take place is because the engineers simply did not believe that there would be a way to be able to remotely attack this system, and they were wrong. So they had no security controls in the system. This happens time and time again. So when you say about the lock, I don't know the answer to that. I hope that they understand that they need to build a security even if they don't see the attack surface, but I just don't know. So the core technologies, well, we've been talking a lot about security and privacy. This is clearly an issue we have to worry about. Energy management. As you deploy these various things to your house, how are you going to ensure that they don't burn things completely? If they're in your house, it's okay. You maybe plug into the mains, but for many other applications, you're going to be running on a battery. Placing batteries is very expensive. Real-time computing, how do you actually use this data, the whole sensors and actuators technology, wireless networking, signal processing, sensor control, mobile computing, big data, all the data analytics. These are all issues that need to be addressed in the IoT space. So we call them core technologies. The research challenges we have in this is something that at NSF we are trying to do more in this space to get a discussion going on. For these issues, I actually lifted them from Jack Stankovich's paper called Research Directions for the Internet of Things, appropriately in Volume 1, Number 1 of the IEEE Internet of Things Journal. So this is a fine place to have such a list. Jack is a professor at the University of Virginia and a longtime researcher in cyber-physical systems, and so he's a good source for people thinking about these issues. From what I've seen so far, when I've talked with consortia and with researchers in other countries, funding agencies, a lot of work is being done for the low-hanging fruit, the very simple things, and so looking at the foundational questions is still something that has to be addressed. So I'm just going to go through these topics fairly quickly. Scaling is a huge problem in this area. To give you a very small example, I was visiting about 2 years ago David Culler at Berkeley in their new building, their new computer science building. I forget the name of it. It's a smart building in the sense that it has sensors all over the place and has actuators all over the place, so they were able to program the HVAC while we're sitting in a conference room just to show us what they could do. And one of the issues they had was just the scale of this. How do you get your hands around all the data? This turned out to be a problem. This is a startup problem, but the engineers who built the building had no idea what these sensors and actuators would be used for, so they just sort of put them in place and then handed the keys over. And so the first problem they had to do is figure out what are all these IP addresses and what controls what. So there's a huge discovery problem, understanding what it is that they have. That's going to get better, clearly. But all the issues of dealing with very large-scale systems, what are the protocols for it, how do you get reliability, how do you get your hands around this so you're able to look at a building of, say, 100,000 sensors and be able to understand what the attack surfaces are and what your privacy leakage can be. Those kind of tools are going to be hard. Yeah.
Maybe you're going to get to this later on. My name is Gary Bergros. Are people discussing some of the semantic issues of these problems that you're going through here, or are you going to discuss that later?
I am unaware of anyone doing it at a semantic level, and that I think is just a sign of the immaturity of the field.
I think I'm going to definitely I think we should wait until he finishes all these points, otherwise he'll never get to it. If you don't mind, is it okay with you, Steve?
It's perfectly fine with me.
It's very nice. It's pretty exciting here what you're saying, but I think in terms of interest of time.
Yeah, you've got to keep moving. I understand. But it's a great question, nonetheless. Okay, so architecture and dependencies. So this is a question of how do you get these architectures to actually work with each other. This is a hard thing we're having in cyber-physical systems right now. We're doing much of the work on the control theory, on the design of these. In IoT, this is going to be a huge problem. And as I say, this is something that industry probably will not willingly do because it doesn't help their business model. I think it's something that's going to have to come out of academics or out of government. Knowledge and big data is something I believe industry will do. Analytics is going to be one of the huge money makers, I believe, in IoT and smart cities. Of course, we're going to be generating a huge amount of data on sensors that can have questionable reliability. So how are we going to synthesize all this information? How can we do it in a timely way so that we can get real-time control out of this? How do you couple systems together? These are all important issues. Robustness and criticality. As I say, sometimes people say Internet of broken things right now. They all say I've heard people say Internet of crap, which is another issue as well because many of these are going to be very cheap. But Internet of broken things, we're going to be building applications that are going to depend on these sensors that were probably put in place 20 years earlier because if you put smart things in your home, you're probably not going to upgrade it every 2 years. And they're going to be very cheap. They're going to be inexpensive. And so their ability to be software upgradable, remotely upgradable, probably will be very limited. And so how do you build this kind of system so that it's able to work well together? This is a really good problem. So Ram mentioned clock synchronization. Certainly clock synchronization comes into this level. And just to give you an example, one of the interesting Internet of Things is an operating room, an emergency response room, right? Because there are lots of integrated or not integrated devices in there keeping people alive. And Julian Goldman, who's a researcher who works with us in this area, likes to point out that the clocks are never, ever synchronized. They tend to be blinking. And so being able to figure out how to combine all these things on a system as vital as that is already a problem. Trying to build a platform that allows an operating room to be able to be integrated is still a ways off. Openness integration. I touched on this in the architecture. This is an important problem. One of the things that my colleagues down in engineering like to talk about is the fact that because sensors are going to be so cheap, we're going to want to be able to integrate other things into an Internet of Things environment. The obvious thing being your mobile phone, right? Because unlike the sensors in your house, your mobile phone you're going to be updating every couple of years. At least most of us do. And if you can get the function into that as integrated into part of the system, then you're liable to have a platform from upgrading your ability to sense. So there's work going on in that. That's an openness integration problem. And, of course, once you're doing real-time control all this, trying to deal with the timing issues is hard. Security, we've already touched a little bit on this in terms of the locks. Certainly Congress is scared about this. This is one of the issues they certainly have brought up in discussions. It's hard to not see what's going on in this. Here's an article. from USA Today. This is 2014. The day is fast approaching when your thermostat, washer, even the light bulbs in your lamps will contain embedded computers so they can talk to you and them. And they point out the privacy issue here that if you have such a thing, then someone will be able to tell you haven't been home for a week because your refrigerator door hasn't been opened. Right? So there's tremendous privacy issues going on. There's already been reports, of course, of thermostats being used as an entrance for installing a botnet into a home as a platform. So there's a lot that goes into this. Just to give you some of the issues, this is my favorite one. In October 2014, this is from The Independent, the first cyber death IoT-related will happen, they're claiming in 2015. The people who are talking about this actually were the equivalent of Interpol. These are our police saying that your ability to wage an attack on someone and kill them in an IoT scenario is actually very close to being doable right now. And of course it is, right? You know that. Kevin Fu is the one who showed that it's very, actually in some models of heart defibrillators that are implanted, it's very easy to induce a heart attack. This was an issue because at the time he showed that the former Vice President Dick Cheney had one of these. And so you really need to get to protect these kinds of devices. Of course, there's other examples here. Remote steering attack, that was the model I just talked about in the OnStar hacking baby monitors. You can swear at babies, that's just a weird thing. But it's pretty disturbing. And a study of top 10 IoT devices across multiple categories found vulnerabilities in 70% of these. So this issue of security is obviously a major issue. Privacy is a huge issue in this as well.
Privacy and security are actually distinct things, although a lot of people like to say you can't have privacy without security. There's some truth to that. Other people say they're duals of each other. I don't believe that's true. Some people think they're synonymous. We're right now actually developing a strategic plan of federal government for research and privacy. And the issue is that the amount of information that's being collected in the case of IoT is clearly an issue that we're worrying about in our strategic plan. The FTC is worrying about, of course. And all the issues were about controls of data collection, controls of data use, tagging data are all issues that are going to be important.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now? I can't hear any difference, so test. Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.
Do you know what slide number that is?
That's a good question.
Slide 25.
Thank you. Slide 25, thank you. So, privacy is clearly an issue in this. And finally, human integration. I've talked about this a couple of times. How do you integrate people into these systems is important. I think one of the issues we're having is a lot of the IoT energy is coming from engineers. I was trained as an engineer myself. Engineers are not known as being the most socio-technical people in the world, not necessarily understanding how people are going to react to things. My colleagues in SBE, Social Behavior and Economic Sciences, like to say that they're getting tired of engineers asking them to do research on how to get people to use their stuff, you know, because the stuff is good. And so clearly there's a whole issue of how do you design these systems that's important. How do you design systems that have human in the loop? So that's my brief pass through IoT. I want to be mindful of my time, so let me tell you a little bit about my cyber physical systems program so you can see what's going on in this. In CPS, we are interested in many of the issues I've talked about: transportation, energy, industrial automation, healthcare and biomedical, critical infrastructure. These are all things that, from our point of view, are being impacted by IoT. We see high degree of automation, a potential human role in this, dependable operation, the need that these systems have to be correct and certified, and their networking controlled at multiple levels. And the observation that Helen Gill, the person who started this, the person who invented the term CPS, said CPS will transform how we interact with the physical world, just like the Internet transformed how we interact with one another. So I want to keep moving here. CPS, because I have till 3 o'clock, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I better keep moving. So in CPS, we have this one diagram called the DAISY diagram. The idea here is that there are many different kinds of cyber-physical systems that apply in different application sectors, or what NIST likes to call verticals, automotive, aeronautical, medical, agricultural, vertical farming, manufacturing, civil materials. And what CPS is doing is not trying to solve the union of the problem, but the intersection. the core science, technology, and engineering that are necessary to make this all work. That's why we created the program, so that we'd be able to generate these kinds of smart systems that interact with the physical world so they can be correct, certified, low energy, and so on. There's been a lot of call for CPS going back, all the way back to 2007 by the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology, recommending cross-disciplinary work in CPS. This has all gone through 2010 and 2011. And so we have responded as agencies to this. We have been doing this. We launched in 2009. This is just NSF. We have well over $200 million of investment in this, about 300 awards. We have 350 PIs and co-PIs scattered across 35 states. And we've added other agencies to our solicitation. So we view this as very quickly we've been able to get up to speed in this. We also have a senior steering group in cyber-physical systems. I don't know how many of you know what NIDRT is. NIDRT is a Network and Information Technology Research and Development. It's the way the agencies interact with each other, coordinate their research with each other. I like to say it's the most important agency you've never heard of trying to coordinate research. And we stood up a couple of years ago a senior steering group in this area. I chair with Chris Greer from NIST. And we have Homeland Security, Department of Defense, Transportation, NASA, National Institute of Food and Agriculture, NIST. We have several agencies that are involved in working in this area. Just a bunch of things that we fund. To show you just how we're doing this, about a quarter of the grants we've given have been in the sense and control aspect of it. This is really the main thing we do. Safety and verification, though, is a very close second. Security is a smaller piece. This is data analytics, which is hugely important. Platforms is small. I really would like that to be larger because the interaction is going to be important for this. By the application domain, by the sectors or the verticals, we've done an awful lot in transportation, even more in unmanned and robotics, autonomy basically. Energy has been a large piece through smart grid, infrastructure, and manufacturing is something that's small but is growing quickly because the industrial applications of this is important. And this just shows you that we fund everyone. This just shows you the numbers that we've done in the different states. These are some examples of our largest investments in this, so you can see what we're doing. Roseline, including UC San Diego, is looking at quality of time and synchronization for cyber-physical systems across different domains. Foundations of Resilient Systems, this is out of Berkeley, the Forces Project. They're looking at economic incentives and resilience for CPS and energy and transportation. The Safety, Security, and Reliability of Medical Devices, CPS, this is out of Penn State along with Massachusetts General Hospital. When I mentioned the operating room, the critical care room, and the fact that costs were not synchronized, that's work that they've been working on. So you see, we're covering many different things. Autonomous transportation, that's out of CMU, that's that car that drove people around. We've done a lot of very large investments and are making, I think, great progress in this area. We also realize that we need to build a community in this area, so we've funded what we call a virtual organization. That's because when we started this, there really was no community ready to stand up in cyber-physical systems. This has actually worked quite well. Our partners on this are the Federal Highway, DARPA, the NSA has been using this for the science of security. Have like 140 special interest groups, and we're just opening this up for resolicitation right now. This has been one of the big successes in getting people involved. So I can show you lots and lots of things we funded. Here's my city's project. I'm trying to be mindful of the time. I want to open up for discussion, so I'm just going to flash these by. I got to show you this. This is a cyber-physical dog. This dog has it's owned by, you don't see his owner here. The idea is that this is a haptic device, so you can control the dog by the basis of how this vibrates on his back. And then this dog can be used for search and rescue. You also have various cameras and ways to be able to interact as the dog is able to go places where a human can't. It's actually very cute. These same guys are also instrumenting cockroaches. They're not so cute. But you can control how a cockroach runs by basically changing the chemistry on their antenna, and they can go places as well. And so actually, I think the PI will sell you a kit to program your own cockroaches if you'd like to do that. They're actually sort of popular. This is out of forces. This is for dealing with traffic. They have a great partnership going on with NIST. NIST has this Global Cities Technology Challenge,
Global Cities Teams Challenge. This is out of the engineering division, director of engineering lab, EO. Thank you. And they've been pulling together partnerships of industry, metropolitan areas, and researchers to solve new prototypes in the area of smart cities. So we stepped up and put $2.5 million behind this to help fund our researchers who are working on this to try to push things along. I wish I was trying to get them all funded by it so I could tell you what they are. All I can tell you is that they're really, really good. You'll like them. But since they haven't been made public yet, we'll have to wait a week or so. We're also worried about education. Jack Stankovich is doing this. We funded a National Academy of Science study. And we have a joint solicitation out, which includes a co-op with what are the foundational needs of learning power. How do we go from the Internet of Things to the Internet of dependable mobile things at enormous scale? In fact, right now,
yes. Microphone.
Am I off again?
Yeah.
That's, oh my God.
We keep shifting from listening to you.
I'm going to carry it like this. I'm really sorry. So, I want to give you a little time for question and answer. So there's much that's going on in our solicitation that just hit the street. We have partners across the agencies. We're working with the Department of Homeland Security in terms of cybersecurity for these cyber-physical systems. They create wonderful attack surfaces. We're working with the Federal Highway Administration Intelligent Transportation System for basically the fleet communication, car to infrastructure communication, the problems arise from that. We're doing autonomy with NASA. NIH, we are doing things in terms of biomedical implants. So this has been a fruitful collaboration. We're also have built some bridges with industry. We have a partnership with Intel recently that is looking at security of cyber-physical systems. We are funding a couple of large centers in this space. There are other projects that are coming up in this space as well. Oh my gosh, so many things going on. Let me just finish on this. CPS security is critical. This is something we're quite worried about. I've mentioned it many times. We are interested in accelerating the transition of CPS programs to practice because we are building these systems that can be safe. The faster we can get this technology in practice, the better our chances are of building these kinds of new applications so that they will be safe. We're partnering with other agencies to bring people into the loop. And so this is where we're going. I'm just going to show you this one slide. At one point, when we were trying to come up with a new name for CPS, I was calling it Star Trek World. Because if you think about the way Star Trek used to be, that's sort of what we're trying to do, a world that we integrate seamlessly with our technology around us. But perhaps that's a better way to think of it. So let me stop here and open up for questions. Yes?
Do you see any impact from the research that's being sponsored here on legislation, either in this country or the European Union, for instance, certification things? And what comes to mind is something like the FDA, right? They control productions, or they try to provide some standards for productions of certain things.
NSF doesn't do policy, of course.
No, I said, do you anticipate impact?
Yes. Right. I think, for example, some of the output of like what's going on in our project that's being used for operating systems rooms, those kind of things, I see certainly impact on. They're certainly talking about the need for legislation or policy change. So, indeed. I gave a talk at the FTC about a year ago on this exact topic as they were worrying about legislation needs for privacy and security of devices.
Other questions? Online.
Yeah, and you're...
Yeah, so Robbie's online.
Do you want, okay. In your list of properties and attributes about this, I'm thinking when you were talking about all the inherent problems in the product development and design, is there any interest in getting into resiliency or redundancy of these systems that are being marketed? Because if they fail, you know, there's no fallback position because everything is thrown out and this new technology adopted.
Right. I think using redundancy, replication, both physical replication, semantic replication is something that I already know people are talking about. Certainly in the Forces project at Berkeley, I believe they're talking about semantic replication. So being able to use different ways to measure the same information.
You know, all this technology is out there, you know, and that's coming in the future, you know, as future tense. What happens if things start failing or, you know, there's some sort of crisis?
As I said, we undervalue risk until it happens to us, then we overvalue it. And I think historically we've always fallen into this trap. But it's also the case, you realize that right now what's out there is just a tiny fraction of what's going to be out there 5 years from now. The technology base is rapidly evolving.
Okay, so we have two questions, one from Ravi and then Gary.
Ravi, I can go on whenever you say.
Go ahead, Ravi.
Resilience, of course, came the last end of this, but I was having two questions for the speaker. One is about OnStar. Was taking care of a child using OnStar network was a good thing or a bad thing? I didn't hear it too well while you were talking, because I was instrumental in designing OnStar architecture of olden times. It has been modernized since.
I certainly did not mean to say you did a bad job, if that's what you're asking.
No, it is just that I'm more interested in building resilience, reliability, robustness, and backup in case of fail-safe
yes.
systems.
So
we were working on Apollo with the motto, fail, fail, fail safe.
Mm.
So even if a tertiary system, not the secondary, but the tertiary system failed as a backup system, it would fail in a safe mode. That's the kind of thing we need on cyber physical, something that touches human being or can cause injury to other human beings.
Yes.
That's the motive for asking question.
Yes. So I agree with you. The example I like to give about how difficult that problem is actually in a car motif. Imagine a car of the future, an autonomous vehicle, and you're driving across a bridge, a one-lane bridge, and you're busily updating your Facebook page on your phone because you can do that. It's autonomous, right? And it's a mixed driving scenario. We know we're going through this. Not all cars will be autonomous. And you're barreling along fairly tight. There's a truck behind you going way too fast, following you too closely, and a pedestrian steps out in front of you. What is the right thing for the autonomous vehicle to do at this point? Should it hit the pedestrian? Should it go off the bridge into who knows what? Should it ram on the brakes and be rammed by the truck behind it? I mean, the right thing to do is at that point, of course, the driver is busily updating the Facebook page. So the problem is that the model is flawed. We have to find a better way.
Well, obviously, not want the Facebook page update to have any priority over driving. If the person is attached to steering wheel or even remotely controlling it, they would not be allowed to have their body organs or anything, even thinking, to be blocked from doing other IP address access. Do what you do best.
Yeah.
And be aware of situation.
That's
anything
right.
like
you have to make sure that the person is aware of what's going on.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, to finish your question on OnStar, I'll be very quick. The problem was that it was there were vectors for attack on OnStar. And once they were able to get in, it turns out the actual control system of the car had no controls on it, no security, no access control. And they were able to deploy commands very simply to do things like brake. So
yes.
I have a quick comment on these related problems or issues of security and uncertainty of knowledge mentioned along the way. The internet has a range of information, some of it right, some of it wrong.
Yeah.
So I can imagine something similar being applied in the case of IoT, and that because of that, because there will be some things that will be more certain than others, there would be essentially some subnet that would be involved, trusted. There'd be some trusted subnets that would be involved. Other things would be more open and subject to proof and testing over time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think some of the issues is offline. Can you hear me?
The battery may be saving itself. Or something.
Oh, no,
goes into the mute. I don't know why, but it's an intelligent system.
Semi-intelligent.
Maybe Gary didn't like your question.
So I think there are certainly issues in the networking that we need to address. Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any other questions here? On the online?
Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
That was fascinating.
Wrong one. This one.
I mean, delete this, and then we will be done. And you have a copy of my presentation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you again, sir.
Okay, now I think we go to track C. And who's presenting tax? Let me see if I can see the agenda around here, I think. How do we get there? Michael, do you have any idea in terms of the web here? Maybe this one. I'm telling you something.
Hi.
Hi,
Mike. We're just pulling up your slide.
Whose slide? We are the slides.
The slides are called Track C Symposium Synthesis, Campus Ossie Mike Bennett, 2015-04-13.ppt or PDF.
Mike Bennett is getting the talk. So, yeah, so Mike, are you going to talk? I think, Mike, you can go ahead, except that I state the slide number. I think we are on one right now, and now are you, who has the control? We have the control, I guess, no, Michael? We have the slide control, not he. Okay, so you got to tell us the slide number, okay?
Yeah, sure thing. There's a funny background noise. Hopefully that will go away again. That's better. Hi, everyone. So track C is all about decision-making in different domains, and we ranged across quite a number of interesting things in doing that. So co-champions and this, there should really be three names here, I think, because there's Michael Gruninger, who did most of the work and organization, Ken McCloskey, who wrote most of the slides and did the hard work behind the scenes, and myself, Mike Bennett, who pops up to give the presentations from time to time. So all this work is really the hard work of others, just so you know. So slide two, just to recap the theme of the summit and the decision making part of this and how it all fits together. So what we were looking to think about was methodology for development of terminologies for multimodal data or ontologies, developing the appropriate kinds of ontologies, testing methods, interoperability, and so on, and using these ontologies in decision making. So that sounds a bit of a mouthful, but it gives a sense of the broad remit we set ourselves in this track to look at all different aspects of decision making in the Internet of Things and how that relates to different kinds of ontology or different ways of using ontology. So to boil that down into slide three, to boil that down into a couple of simple statements. The mission we set ourselves was to explore several different approaches to automated inferencing or inference processing in different applications across a whole range from complex event processing, situation awareness, manufacturing, of course, and a number of other interesting areas. So what we wanted to do was figure out what are the key problems in the Internet of Things which either require or would benefit from some kind of automated reasoning. So those are sort of familiar with formal ontologies and the semantic web. There's lots of applications that reason over information if it's structured within an ontology, and how would we be able to benefit from that. So that's one of the motivating scenarios for feeling that there's a need to have ontologies in the Internet of Things. And so this would be problem areas such as decision support, and also a theme that came up quite a few times then, integrating an interoperability between devices. You'll see there are some interesting challenges on that in, for example, military and manufacturing scenarios, and some of the interesting stuff we've just been hearing about with automated dogs and cockroaches and things and houses that can kill you and all that. So the whole question of being able to integrate, being able to understand both the opportunities and indeed the threats between devices on the Internet of Things. So we set ourselves the mission of addressing the challenges for these kinds of applications. So on the one hand, what would be the role of ontology languages? And we actually looked into, you know, the kind of trade-off between its ability of different representations of formal semantics. Can we use existing ontologies? So whether, for example, standards and other published ontologies for academia and so on that describe a given domain, are these adequate for supporting the kinds of applications that we start to envisage as being possible through the Internet of Things? And how scalable are different approaches to the two kind of almost competing ideas or requirements of semantic integration and automated reasoning? So that's perhaps a clearer idea of the mission we set ourselves on this track. So slide 4, and not all of these have the number, I'm sorry, I dropped some in and failed to number them. So slide 4, speakers, session 1. So in common with the other tracks in this summit, we had two sessions, one early on in the first half of the summit and one later on. So in the first session, we had a talk by Joseph Capena of Bellerophon Mobile on ontology-based information-centric tactical edge networking. But explain what that means. This was a very interesting in-depth analysis of this kind of military and security tactical situations where you have huge ranges of different kinds of thing going on, different kinds of device, different networks, different requirement levels, and so on. So very in-depth look at that kind of military type of scenario. Then Adrian Paschke from the Freie Universität of Berlin talked about going from complex event processing, so talking about the semantics of events and event processing and various standards and bits of work on that, and taking that forward to a thing called the ubiquitous pragmatic web. So it's a very in-depth technical details in that presentation. Then Michael Gruninger of the University of Toronto, and one of the co-champions of this track, talked about process ontologies for smart objects in manufacturing. So the other kind of big sweet spot that we often think of in Internet of Things, which is all the devices in process control and automatic shutdown and other aspects of manufacturing. And Michael treated us to a whole in-depth analysis of process models and process notations and standards and ways of describing the process dimension of that and how that relates to how we talk to various objects that that will be connected together in the Internet of Things in a manufacturing scenario, and flushed out some interesting questions about the balance between the integration of the concepts across things and the application of automated, you know, programmatic decision making to those things. We'll come on to some of the insights in a moment. And then finally, in the first session, we had Ken Bukrowski of Northeastern University, our third co-champion of this track, talking about situation awareness, various situation protocols and descriptions and so on, and again, event models and things, and how these things can be brought together to assist in decision making in the context of different physical situations and so on. Then the second session, session two, we had three speakers this time. So we had Marco Rostocher of the Fondazione Bruno Kessler talking about a ontological framework for decision support. So describing different requirements of information and so on that, and models of different aspects of decisions and so on from a kind of more human decision support perspective. Then Bill Murdoch of the IBM Watson Research Center treated us to a deep dive behind the screen, as it were, of the IBM Watson, so the system that won that Jeopardy contest a couple of years ago, gave us some really interesting insights into, you know, the balance between the use of ontologies and other kind of statistical methods and the way that Watson addresses the challenges in deciding when and how to answer questions, when not to answer questions, and so on. So very much, again, decision-making at several levels there. And then Matthew Giannini of Sky Foundry talked about the role of ontologies in building automation. And this was a semantic model around different building-related concepts like heating and ventilation, climate control, all these different kinds of things, and how they've built a semantic model, interestingly, not using the kind of semantic web notation that we're used to, but using their own notation for that, and that starts some lively conversations about possible opportunities going forward. So just to summarize then what these different case studies were, so we talked, as I say, we started with military situation awareness from Joe Capena. We had enterprise decision management. We had a manufacturing a case study, a sort of context. We had healthcare. We had cloud services. We had customer services, financial services, back to the environment again. And then, as I say, the Jeopardy style case study of question answering, which is being applied in a number of different ways now, not just answering quizzes, and the building automation scenario. So these are the different kind of business contexts in which we've looked at the application of ontologies and reasoning and so on for decision support in these different scenarios in the context of the Internet of Things. So we tried to boil down a number of the insights that we got from these various talks. I'm sure there's many things we missed, but I'll run through a few of the things that came out both from the talks and from the very lively chat room discussions that went around all of these talks as well. One theme that came up a few times, in fact, and seemed to go a long way, is that a little semantics goes a long way. And particularly, and here's where really the decision-making aspect that we're focusing on interfaces with the questions around integration and so on, because if you've got, you know, a lot of different kinds of things, like you do in a military situation awareness type of scenario or in a manufacturing scenario, then the semantics you need to integrate a large number of things is actually quite light compared to the level of semantics you need to do actual automated decision making and reasoning over those things. And so there's an interesting balance there. So a little semantics goes a long way from an integration point of view. The point was made that getting developers without knowledge representation experience up to speed is quite difficult. I could echo this from other areas I've been working in, but knowledge representation as a body of knowledge is very distinct from what it takes to program some of this stuff. And there still seems to be a rare few individuals that have a foot in both those camps. So often the project applications that people were dealing with didn't get to the point of utilizing all of the capabilities that were actually offered by the underlying model. So that was an interesting insight. Slide 8. Sorry, I forgot the numbers. Slide 8. Insights and lessons learned again. So there were some project challenges then from a project management point of view, building on that last point about how you pull the project together. Determining the relevance of different things, security considerations, we heard some hair-raising examples of those in the previous talk. The amount of effort required for testing, the very thing of testing ontologies is quite a raises quite an interesting set of questions compared to simply testing an application. Human versus non-human inputs. Again, earlier today we had this fascinating insight that pain, when pain is measured, your instrument is a human being. So there was quite a lot of places where you're dealing with human inputs, human knowledge, particularly in tactical and situational context, again, where you're not all of the things in your Internet of Things are actually things. And also handling uncertainty. If you've got a range of different things that are all networked together, the provenance of the assertions they make, or even the truth of the assertions they make, can be quite variable. So those are some of the interesting challenges at a kind of project level of, you know, what can you actually deliver and how do you actually pull together a project that delivers on that. There are also some quite interesting architectural questions that came up. So what networking architectures, in some situations we saw you may have several networks or several kinds of networks. Even in manufacturing you have different styles of network, and the more you're integrating different kinds of things, the more you have to think about these kind of interfaces between peer-to-peer networks versus more information-centric networks and so on. And along with that, if you're doing queries and stuff or decision-making around the whole network of things, the question of how you optimize or frame those queries, how you distribute the different pieces, suddenly becomes very complex. And another thing that came up in a couple of the talks was going beyond basic, you know, first order ontological representation of things into the use of rules that, you know, apply higher orders of logic and processing to ask more difficult questions of the things that are out there. So that's another set of insights. Slide 9. So digging more deeply now into some of the insights that came out of the different sessions, and I should just watch the time, I think. But again, going back to the first talk from Joe Capino, the evaluation of knowledge representation systems is extremely difficult. So we talked about, you know, the knowledge gap, if you like, between knowledge representation and some of the programmatic side of things. Performance questions are non-trivial to deal with. What might be hard for a network versus what's hard from a knowledge representation point of view. How you actually test the effectiveness of the applications you're using, or the, you know, decision making and so on. And again, coming up with effective test scenarios and understanding the different scenarios that are involved in that can be very difficult to quantify. So that was one interesting set of insights. And we talked a few times in the number of the conversations and presentations about the tools for the task. So, you know, we come to this from the point of view of ontology, and we think in particular of RDF and OWL ontologies and the corresponding query language, Sparkle. Sometimes those are the right tools for the task, and sometimes they're not. So there's some interesting architectural considerations that people need to take into account when querying a knowledge base using Sparkle versus when you're dealing with more dynamic data and data in different architectures and things. some, I won't go into details, but it's worth being aware that some of the questions aren't as simple as we might have first thought. Slide 10. Also, one thing that came out from Michael Gruninger's talk, automated reasoning is quite difficult. You know, some queries you might want to answer might not be answerable in the realistic time limits of the application. We had a deep dive there about how to isolate different lemmas or different parts of the decision-making stuff to optimize the balance between, you know, having an overall semantics of the concepts on the one hand and being able to apply reasoning to get results at the sharp end of the applications themselves. And so Michael itemized and recommended a number of interesting approaches that you need to take for dealing with this problem. So if you thought that you could take one huge overarching ontology and just shove lots of stuff in it and do all the reasoning in real time, you might find that it ain't that simple. So that was again a theme that came up a few times, I think. And expanding on that, then what we were seeing was a kind of trade-off between the reasoning complexity and the limitations of, you know, do you limit it to description logic, so you've got some sort of confidence in how efficiently you can carry out reasoning. If you want to do more kind of more ambitious, more real time kind of processing, I won't try and describe the details, but the trade-offs here require a fair amount of understanding and research between what kinds of axioms to have in the ontology and which ones are useful or applicable to the task in hand. So it may not always be a case of just creating an ontology and throwing in every axiom you can think of. There's a real kind of engineering trade-off to be done there. Some semantic issues that come up as well. So something that comes up quite often in other scenarios, like classification of books and top and articles and so on. You look at things like SCOS, for example, the distinction between type hierarchies and topic hierarchies, kinds of thing versus kinds of books about a thing or kinds of articles about a thing. And that same scenario applies when you're looking at the readings made by those things in your internet of things which happen to be measuring something. So all your sensors in a manufacturing process or in many other contexts where there's an aboutness to the value of the variable that you're actually describing in your ontology. And a lot of lists to be had from when to use concept references to be able to apply some of that knowledge representation thinking about distinguishing kinds of concept within a broader semantic framework. One thing that doesn't drop out neatly from that kind of ontology approach is the nature of sequences. So this is where some use of some lattice that represents time, for example, might be needed to be able to describe sequences and orders and times and other non-trivial things like that. And that raised again this question of what tools and languages to use, when to use alternatives to Sparkle and RDF, so when to have, say, you know, some system that deals with the semantics at one level but then turns it into other kinds of queries for different kinds of data. I think a lot of the talks kind of touched on those kinds of alternative architectures. We heard about the pragmatic web. At the other end of the scale, the schema.org with its simple definitions of concepts, and various other tooling questions, logic translation and so on. So a lot of stuff that wasn't as simple as you'd first think when we dig down into the range of case studies that we looked at. Slide 11. So just to highlight a little bit more on the manufacturing side, then manufacturing processes themselves are very complex. So different objects flow through a sequence of processes. I was at a ontology conference a while ago, and we went to a bottling plant where they bottle one of these very, very strong beers that they like to drink in the Low Countries. And just watching bottles go round the thing, which just seems such a simple thing, is itself very, very complex. Because when you have this complex set of relations between the object as it flows through a sequence of processes, the object itself, of course, changing as it goes through that, you have to therefore have a good model of the process itself and the different activities, the sort of, you know, branching to different things that can happen next and so on. And as soon as you get away from something as simple and linear as putting lids on bottles, you can end up with very non-deterministic process plans. So having this very formal process language that Michael Gruninger described to us is really critical there. And a first order process ontology can be used to create the kind of, if you define it right, again with this partitioning of, you know, describing kinds of thing which are process and kinds of thing which are event and all the other building blocks of process, then you can start to create smart objects that can reason about the manufacturing process itself in which the object participates rather than just reasoning about the objects themselves. And, you know, this comes back to, you know, some of the ideas around smart items themselves, having items that understand where they are in a process and can be dynamically self-rooted. So there's some interesting ideas there. Slide 12, more insights then. Complex event processing, just to build on what we were just hearing from Michael's talk, Adrian Pashka talked to some of these issues as well. Again, having the semantics of event, having ontology design patterns that describe event and process and other temporary sensitive concepts like that, by defining those event features in the ontology itself, it becomes declarative knowledge within a formal ontology while still being event data. And that lets you reason not just over things, but over situations and states and the other things that event processing requires. And again, you can start to talk about intelligent agents and how different agents within your system can be reasoning over these situations and states that have been defined in a formal ontology in this way. So that was, you know, some use of declarative knowledge-based processing of events and reactions and states and situations and so on. And Adrian expanded that to talk about the pragmatic web as being the set of tools and practices and theories about how people use information and linking that back into the semantics and the syntax in like three layers essentially that lets us talk about not only the form or the meaning of information but the actions and interactions which bring about commitments and understandings and representations and so on between things that are interacting with each other. So very much an Internet of Things scenario. Slide 13. So then, decisions are made within a context. So again, building on not just Adrian's work here, but Ken McCluskey's work as well, we get that situation assessment is central to information fusing, that situation awareness, as we just heard, is a, you know, part of the event processing side of things. And then decisions themselves are made within a process. And here we bring together, I think, all three of those last three talks that we're just getting the insights from here. You have events, you have models of events, you have processes that are sets of events with a clear process modeling sort of pattern, if you like. And so now you can talk about how decisions are made within the process, how event processing happens. And we heard about things like in manufacturing, you have these feedback loops called OODA loops and various other formal models of kind of, you know, negative feedback and positive feedback types of loops, a bit like PIDs and so on in process control. So a lot of very interesting detailed treatment of how the process is modeled and how decisions are made in that process and how we use ontologies and other things to inform those decisions and help people or machines make those decisions. Slide 14. So now a very different side of decision making. The Jeopardy, the IBM Watson, and the Jeopardy example. So IBM Watson is itself a very, very interesting thing, of course. It uses not just ontology, but a number of other statistical and other techniques, and there's a lot of processing power at the problem. Jeopardy itself, for those that don't live in the United States, is a quiz in which the format is slightly back to front, because the quizmaster gives you the answer and you have to frame the question. So that's slightly different to the way you would otherwise even use Watson in, you know, medical applications and so on, where more typically you come up with questions and what you want to hear from the machine is the answers. So they chose that deliberately difficult way round in order to really get some interesting ideas out of this thing. So it also means that Watson itself is making decisions. Because this is a quiz question of like amounts of money you bet on your certainty of a given answer, it has to decide not only what the answer is, but how confident it is that it should give that answer, or just sit on the money and not get, you know, thrown out of the game, or whatever happens if you get too many answers wrong. So there's a whole kind of meta level of not only figuring out the answers, but figuring out the confidence levels of the answers. So it's a sort of level of self-awareness almost between what the machine knows and what the machine knows it knows. You have to do a half Rumsfeld there. So there was some very, very interesting insights from that. I recommend looking at the slides for this and indeed most of the others. So question answering, slide 15 in Jeopardy. When we're answering a question, we presume there's a unique correct answer to the question, and decision support is simply about finding the answers. The decision making, taking it further, can be regarded as the cognitive process that results in a selection of a belief. Do I know the answer to this question, for example? Do I believe that Toronto is an airport in the United States, and so on? That's the one that Watson got wrong. And so in some of these scenarios, there is no unique answer, or there might be a correct answer, but not one that one can verify. And of course, the applicability of that to things like medical diagnosis is fairly obvious. And so it's an area that Watson has been applied in quite a lot. So question answering and decision making have quite a lot in common, but it's not a straight one-to-one. A system designed for one may or may not be suitable for the other without some effort. As I say, if you program it to win Jeopardy, it's going to give you questions instead of answers. So there's a certain amount of thinking required as to how to apply something like Watson to a more conventional decision-making scenario. And we cross-examined them on that and got some interesting answers and insights. Other lessons. So on the building side, we had an interesting conversation. This standard called Project Haystack that's been developed in the building services world addresses common problems with things like being able to onboard a boiler into a building when you have different boilers that have different specifications in a different order and so on. And then you have, you know, your sensors, your thermostats and flow measures for ventilation and so on, your different measures of energy and so on. There was a clear need by that industry to standardize on the concepts that they use so that they could get much, much better interoperability, similar to the challenges we faced in the financial sector and elsewhere. You know, have all these different, unnecessarily different sets of terms and so on. So they come up with their own meta model for defining the concepts, and that includes kinds of thing and relationships between things. And they didn't use the web ontology language, or indeed any language that was grounded in formal logic in the way that the web ontology language is. But the meta model they had was quite comparable to having an OWL meta model. So we felt it would be actually quite a interesting opportunity to take the work they've done in this Project Haystack and reframe the semantics in something like the web ontology language simply by identifying commonalities between the two meta models. And that would then open up the building services world or the Haystack world to other standard ontologies for units of measure and other things that are already applicable to energy and flow and other measures that these things are making. So I think in that last conversation on that last session, we opened up some interesting channels of communication for helping the guys in building services make more use of the kind of formal ontology that many of us are used to. And clearly without that, they weren't really talking about automated reason-based decision-making like a lot of the other stuff we've seen. They're talking about supporting decisions for humans to make and so on, and really more about integration again. So that was the main lessons learned. And I'll leave you slide 17 with a nice slide from Adrian Paschke of Freie Universität in Berlin, the pragmatic web and its evolution as a step beyond the semantic web. So starting with what he calls the desktop, then the syntactic web, so having, you know, HTML and so on, and XML, and then bringing that into the semantic web, the social semantic web, and finally this ubiquitous pragmatic web 4.0 to connect intelligent agents and smart things. So again, the Internet of Things and the agents that need to make decisions around them and about the stuff that they're talking about in their little networks. So that was very useful slide to, I think, hold all this together. So with that, I'll pause for any questions. I think we have 5 minutes for questions, right? Any questions?
I really like this.
You've
got to unmute everyone.
Ah, I thought it was quiet. It was so quiet, I wondered if I would just be spending 40 minutes talking to myself, but it wouldn't be the first time.
Gary, so I really like ending on this slide here, in part because the Internet of Things will change not only if we add more things and events and processes, but as the Internet evolves to a pragmatic Internet or a more socially aware Internet. Mm. Too. So I like that. That's sort of the foundation on which it's built also raises as we go along.
Yes, so I particularly thought that the emphasis we had in several talks about process and event and so on, mm-hmm. Something I've done in my work is try and use the partitions to describe not just the ontology of things in the sense of something you can poke with a stick, but things that are events and states and so on. And I think we're just beginning to explore some very useful ways of bringing together the kind of static and the dynamic sides of the world, you know, the sort of decorative and the more process thing. So I'd like to dig more into the work that Adrian's been doing here.
Terry?
Yeah, just a quick question. On your slide 10, Mike, you had one in the middle. Yeah. Now I don't see it now. There was a question about something being different than categories and how you. Oh, there it was. Action types versus usefulness.
Right. So what do I mean by that?
A topic versus hierarchies. That's what I was wondering about.
Oh. Topic versus type hierarchies. There's, oh yes, okay. Yes, that was. I can't remember why that was directly relevant here. But it's something I've been grappling with elsewhere, but I think it came up here for some reason. So, oh yes, I remember why. Yes. So if you think about, if you look at something like SCoS, you have, you know, broader and narrower, but it can be any kind of broader and narrower, including inclusion, and, you know, for example, a book about French grammar is narrower than, so French grammar is narrower than French, which is narrower than language. So those are actually hierarchies of topics. Whereas the type hierarchy would be a book about French is a a book about French grammar is a book about French, which is a book about language, but French grammar isn't a kind of French. You know, there's that difference between topic and type. And where this seems to be relevant with some of the sensor networks is understanding when the ontological thing that you're representing is, I'm sure I described as well, there's an aboutness. You know, you're measuring, you're not necessarily measuring the thing, you're measuring some measurement about the thing. So, probably worth a deeper dive here. Maybe I should try and go back. But you know, you've got a non-direct relationship sometimes between, if you have an ontology of real things and you say something about this thing that is its temperature or its speed or something like that, but actually the ontology that you need to apply to the sensors is ontologizing the sensor data, which itself has aboutness. It says this is the speed of something as far as this sensor is concerned, not necessarily the fact of the thing itself. So there's an indirectness there, which I think maybe not always, but in some cases requires an understanding of the distinction between the aboutness of a topic hierarchy of concepts. I wish I could think of a concrete example, because it's all very abstract otherwise.
You've got in the chart called lessons learned. Have we learned that lesson yet, or is that still an open question?
Ah, I think it comes under the heading of insights rather than lessons learned. That's a good question. I think
I'm going to interrupt here for a second.
You
seem to have said that Michael Groninger, no? About that it comes from there and not from you, no? From that somewhere else, okay. Michael is off the hook then.
So this is Gary. Yeah. I have had my hand up for just a quick comment on this. So when I think of this, you have the observations that essentially can evoke a ontology which has types in it. But as a human, in terms of our mental model, we not only necessarily evoke that particular thing, we invoke an assembly of things around it. So unlike the ontology, the usual ontology we build, a topic essentially gets activated. We know some of this from psychological studies by what it enables when things are evoked. So essentially, if we want to sort of expand our Internet of Things, be more human-like, we would have this sort of more activation than just a strict type hierarchy. We would have related topics essentially being also stimulated.
So those are current ontology systems? Is that a shortcoming? It's current ontology?
Maybe of artificial intelligence as a whole and knowledge systems as part of that.
It might be a shortcoming if you don't carefully model. I'm just thinking now, the example is when not every element in your Internet of Things is a thing. Sometimes they're people, and this is particularly relevant in tactical, for example, military scenarios. So the sensor you're looking at might be a observer sitting in a, you know, sitting behind some sandbags with some binoculars, and the thing they're sensing is, you know, something a kilometer away on the other side of the hill. So there's a definite topic requirement there, and as long as the ontology recognizes when it's describing a topic and when it's describing a type, then you should be okay. So there's nothing wrong with ontology.
Mike, I think we're running out of time here, so there's one more question, and then we're going to have a break for about 10 minutes, okay?
Okay, yep.
Well, thanks, Rob. This is Stu Rogers from Tier 1 Performance Solutions. I had a question about a couple of words on slides 9 and 10. There are some references there to Sparkle and RDF. Alternatives to it, or it not being the right tools for the task. And I was just curious if I could hear a sentence or two about what set of tasks were in mind when the deficiencies of Sparkle and RDF were salient.
Mike, that is that question. I guess the issue, the person who kind of made that comment is Joe Capina, who's here. You want him to take the question, or are you going to take the question?
Joe, if you could take the question, I'm looking at your slides now, but that would be great.
Yeah, so in our work, there's really been a couple problems with trying to apply Sparkle and RDS. You know, one of the issues that's touched on, I think, by a couple people is just dealing with modeling and inquiring for data that changes over time, like sensor readings, even simple things like position. So in our work, you know, we have dealt with that by explicitly modeling essentially reports of that data at different time points. but I think that is unwieldy for truly massive data sets. And then the bigger issue in our work was about, you know, the model of what Sparkle returns, essentially. So all of our work is essentially about registries of objects, right? So you're publishing pictures, video clips, all this kind of stuff, and then everyone is collaboratively annotating metadata, describing all of that, and then applications are establishing subscriptions and querying for those content objects. So they'll write a query like, I want a position report from a particular region denoting particular kinds of events, for example. And in Sparkle, you know, you can write all of those conditions very easily, but then the things that get returned are specific atomic variable bindings, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right? So, I mean, you can construct graphs and all this kind of fancy stuff out of it, but that's what you have access to. Whereas what the application developers for our tasks really want to do is essentially match entire metadata objects and say, you know, this report or this image matched my conditions. I want to know everything about it in the registry. And there really isn't any way to capture that in Sparkle.
We're going to get started again. Folks online too. Mark Underwood is going to talk about, what track is this? Track D. Okay. Thanks.
It's interesting that the keynoters didn't talk about Zigbee. If you take that as just one data point in the conversation about standards, I think it says the standards either haven't caught on or they're moving in a completely parallel process that doesn't overlap with the meta problems that we're trying to solve here. I'm going to ask you later, Joe, what you think about that. Maybe they are using the standards and they've integrated them and they don't really need our help with it. We had two presenters in the first round of Track D. They're both, I believe, going to be giving demonstrations tomorrow. So those of you that are not at the face-to-face, I don't know if it's too late to register, but you're going to be missing some interesting hands-on conversations about it. I think the conversation is as important as the demos. So looking forward to that. And you'll get some additional insights into what was presented, I think, there. I don't go into a lot of effort in this slide deck here to talk about that. I've reprised a couple of the slides from William Miller's talk because he represents one of the more active standards groups that's working in the space. So these are the contact points for the two presenters from the first round of this session. And I took this, and this is now me talking, not the presenters, so I'm taking a luxury of doing some integrating and synthesizing on this topic. And what we were trying to find, I think, here between the conversation about what the standards are and what we're trying to do is what the design patterns ought to be for either lightweight ontology methods or lightweight software engineering practices that are not being followed at present. So my goal when I was looking at this in the beginning was, well, let's see if we can influence software engineering practices in some way in IoT, that the current development practices are moving like the standards, perhaps, parallel to what we're doing in ontologies, and see if we can bend the curve in any way. And try to get the semantics out of code, because that's the way most engineering work, and like it or not, is happening. And the fact that there's some greenfield happening in IoT is an opportunity to do things differently. Not sure that this track answers that one way or the other. I think some of the bigger projects, like XMPP, have adapted things that are not new, but have enrolled into commercial products like GoToMeeting. So I'm not sure if we have arrived at a conclusion about that, but I still think, in principle, that there's plenty of greenfield opportunity for IoT. Maybe we just haven't heard about them yet. We've had plenty of conversation on domain-specific already. I don't think that's going to be new. But I do think on the standard side of things, maybe the primary pattern, the design pattern, is the cut-and-paste pattern. And to the extent that we're not empowering the current generation of folks that grew up with GitHub on how to cut-and-paste ontologies or pieces of code that interface to ontologies or APIs to ontologies, means that our adoption rate or uptake is going to be less promising than it might otherwise be. I don't think we address that here, but I think it's clear from the presentations that we're not there yet. So if this group is going to advance the cause in some way, we need to find a path forward because it's not happening in an autonomous way. So I'm not reading the slide number. I'm now on slide five. So this is going to reprise a few decks from William Miller's presentation. So he's involved in the IEEE P21451 XMPP standards group, and it does bake in some semantic information into it. Those of you who didn't see his presentation, it's probably what people in this group would think of as relatively low level, but it's kind of where the pedal hits the metal for this kind of work with it. And the fact that the SENCI, I'm not sure how to pronounce the SENCI IoT group, is using the word semantic in the specification, I think, is telling. So the protocols that he enumerated as ones that are carrying the day from his perspective are the ones listed here on slide three. There's an OASIS group in addition to this XMPP standard that he's working on. There's some REST interfaces, and there's this constrained application protocol that we've mentioned in a couple other previous speakers. So this is the background on slide seven for the standard that he's working on. I'm going to blow by that one as well. On slide eight, I think it's kind of interesting to ask ourselves whether we can map these, and I use this word advisedly, these levels of the standard to process or mapping exercises on the ontologies. And I don't know that we address that so much. For example, if you look at provisioning and you say, have we looked at what the IoT ontology ought to be for provisioning, which is the analog for DevOps and big data? In other words, what's DevOps for IoT and what should the ontology? I don't think we've touched on that, not just in the standards group, but in general, it's probably an opportunity area. And because DevOps is so important to these often single investigator, single developer projects that are greenfield, it probably is a tap forward for making some difference, making a dent and bending the curve a little bit for implementation practices. So this might be, not taking this literally, but kind of a guidepost for a way to influence things is to try to find ontologies that map to the different types or classes of activities that the standards groups are operating in. So this is kind of a snapshot. This is too hard to read, and in our version of this probably is for the online people as well. This is slide nine. If you want to download and look at the version of this, this kind of is a snapshot of how the standards are interoperating in the model that William Miller is working in. So to say that the standards don't matter and look at this is going to be a disconnect, because standards do matter. There's heavy involvement of the standards in the stack that comprises this particular standard. So what difference can the ontologies make in each of these? You're probably going to have a different answer to that question depending on how you dive into the stack. We didn't really tackle that in this track. So I also gave a talk to the IoT Day, which is a day-long meeting similar to this one that's sponsored by William Miller himself and a group that he works with. And I tried to get the ontology, this is mainly engineering people in this group, to think about what the design modularity would have to be for reasoning systems. And this is new information to them. So for this group, really the takeaway is they are interested in what we have to offer them. They do want sort of micro-reasoning, micro-context solutions that ontologies operate, but they want them as plug-ins. They want them as plug-ins that operate in a bigger framework that they can put into Eclipse or they can put into Visual Studio, and they're going to work in some kind of predictable fashion. What they don't want is to have to learn a whole new framework that's sort of outside of their bailiwick, because they mainly are having to bridge this world of the domain that they're operating in and the device engineering itself. So the reason this elementary slide is up here is that the use cases that I try to look at to make sure that our standards conversations are sort of brought back to reality brings to mind that the public, I think, thinks that this problem has already been solved. So if you look at, if you follow this show at all, they have now had at least three shows that I'm aware of that have used IoT cases as a central piece of the evidence gathering. So these forensic cases are ones where the public thinks that this data can be fused from all these sources somehow and made into sense that'll stand up in court somehow. So if you can make one of these up easily yourself, I just made this one up. It's a smart city scenario where a parking garage at an airport collapses. And if you fast forward, and I'm not sure how far you have to fast forward, maybe 5 years or 10 years, and you ask yourself, well, how many of those sensors are out there do I know about? Am I responsible for them? Do I own the data streams for them? Which of them are reliable? Which of them even still work? Because maybe some of them were installed 5 or 10 years ago and aren't operating anymore. And some of them may have been interrupted by incidents related to the collapse of the garage. So how much of this needs to be in the ontology? Well, you could argue the ontology would be pretty handy in a forensic scenario like this, because you sort of want to do speaking very loosely here, you want to do a Google search through all the ontologies to see what the availability is. It may be that standardized interfaces like you would have in a clean discovery environment wouldn't be clean enough for this. And you just want to do a bottom-up search of keywords to see what is out there, what kind of sensors are there, what kind of aggregate information were they storing, was it even in the time frame of what you're interested in here. So the design pattern for this, if you can call it that, is that yes, people can omit ontologies, but taxonomies and the semantics do offer a semblance of order that could be made useful in an analytic situation like a digital forensic. So Joe and I were talking about this slide, so I wanted to make sure I got this in this little talk. It's my belief that there is an implicit divide in the way that developers approach how to write code, and that the prevailing model is the CRAFT model. The CRAFT model is do things fast to make them work. You can learn it yourself at home. It works especially well if you're a teenager who's learned this with available tools at home and with minimal interaction with the outside world, and you learn a lot of things from the hack world, and you make things work fast, and maybe you use Agile to do that, maybe you don't. But the design methodologies are less important than your ability to do it quickly and do a lot in a hurry. So this is sort of a framework agnostic thing. And what this means is the craftsperson approach to IoT projects is going to be to ignore frameworks, to sort of build bit setting around features, to basically just copy the feature set of the sensor devices and these meta devices like smart transducers, and map these into bit arrays, and it'll work. It will work. People will be able to construct working systems from that. They don't like things that involve overhead and high learning curve to figure out how things work. And if it's a bunch of gray-haired people like us that gave the framework to them, all the more reason to not use it. Also, and this is maybe the most key thing, even with the senior developers who are craftspeople, the developer is being asked to impersonate a domain expert. In other words, he has to learn how the sensor environment works. So if you're in an industrial setting and you have to learn how it's like in Michael's use case where it's an SAP environment and you have to go in a factory floor and figure out how things work in the factory, you have to understand a fair amount of that. It's part of your duty as a developer to acquire that knowledge, stick it in your taxonomy, in your use cases, in your classes, in your test environment, and you kind of require the notion that these things are all fused together in one person, because that's how you do it. That's part of why you can be fast about it. The engineering approach, which is kind of the other end of this continuum, is what those of us that are not civil engineers think civil engineering is about, which is you can get a certification in civil engineering. If you pick a civil engineering California and one in New York, they kind of know the same stuff. They have a standard practice that they use when they're going to build a bridge and test a bridge and build blueprints for bridges. They have similar, and so if you're going to use this for IoT, you would have similarities for the way that they build models. So if you have two different devices and you're going to architect that, they would have similar models for going about that. Engineer in New York could read one that was developed by an engineer in California, whereas I don't think that's the case. So an engineer would be more likely to leverage existing models. So that's where the cut and paste thing comes in. I think from what we've seen in the conversations in the track about the standards, they will get that from some of the initial work that's been done in the OASIS groups and the standards that we called out in the first couple of slides here. But if you go any further up the stack from that, there's really nothing to cut and paste from. And so the developers are being invited one way or another to develop their own solutions for that. What does that mean? Well, each generation, if you take the engineering model, gets better, but only if you stay with the project long enough so that the payoff happens for that. So if your idea is to build a fast prototype, forget it. The engineering approach is probably not the one you want. Because to get to the end result of demonstrating the use case to a client or to yourself, it's not the fastest way to do it. You're going to have too many rounds of iteration. You're going to have to learn other people's frameworks. You might have to even change your class names, and all of your imports may have to go through several iterations of modification. So that means slower initial prototyping, but you get faster. You accept overhead. And so one of the things that I think is the case, you would be willing to accept UML models that generated code that worked on devices. That would be an acceptable software engineering model. But in the craft world, you wouldn't do that, right? You don't want to mess with the UML. The UML is a handicap. It's like, it's the thing that's, you know, keeping your Cadillac engine. This is the old metaphor, not true anymore of Cadillac, but the thing that's keeping your Cadillac engine from working properly on your Model T. And the engineers accept fragility as the nature of the beast that they're working with. So if you have the example I was using with Michael when we were talking about this the other night is, anybody use Uber on this trip? Did you get stuck with their congestion pricing model when you tried to use it? Yeah. So when I looked at that, I thought to myself, if I was the developer of that, that would not have been in my use case, right? Because the use case for most of these systems is a static table presented to you by the company of the prices by city, by metro zone, by class of service. So demand pricing is a big data problem. That's why these two, you know, year-on-year experiences in the summit, I think, are really interesting. These two are back-to-back. Because that's a velocity problem of data. In addition to variety, it's a velocity problem. So if you think of everything that's static right now, like insurance is, you know, rated by actuarials in a static way. What if you converted that to a real-time thing where your insurability for car and life insurance and health insurance was day-to-day thing based on real-time data from who knows where? So that model, which probably was not been given to it, would have been thought of as fragile by the developer. Like, well, why didn't you tell me this in the beginning? The argument goes, well, if you had done an ontology, the abstractions in the ontology might have pushed you in the direction of worrying about that because somebody would have said, for all these dimensions could have quantifiable continuous variables instead of discrete ones. So how do you bake in an ontology into the standard? So I've heard some deprecating things said about HL7, but one of the things that's in the what they're calling the FHIR standard, which ONC, in the meetings I've listened in on, I'm not an active participant, but I listen in, is that they have got this, I'm sorry, I haven't been calling out the slide number, so I'm on slide 16. So at the bottom of slide 16 is them baking in some kind of ontology. Now, they don't say what kind of ontology or how good it has to be or how they test it or any of that, or even what kind of person has to build it. But it is there, which you don't see it in a lot of the other standards. So that's sort of a win for our side, if you ask me. One of the design patterns that I thought we should look at as a use case is how to get things like geolocation data into complicated, unanticipated patterns. And so one of those is, going back to this example of the collapsed garage at the airport, how do you know which devices have sensed the gate? This is sort of working backwards from, if you think about it, the measurement data to the sensors, not from the sensors forward to the scene. So the sort of bidirectional scene reasoning thing is something we understand in this group, but I think the developer community wouldn't. That's not the way they would frame the problem of writing code for a sensor. Likewise, they tend not to think of the devices having longevity. And this is another lesson from the big data thing, is there's no such thing as archiving. Everything is permanent. So what this means is when you're asking somebody to write code for an IoT, most of these things are software, firmware-driven. We, for provenance reasons, we want them to save as an executable, a completely recreatable instance of the of the sensor so that we could reconstruct the environment in which it produced it. And that's possible now because of big data. You can save all the packets, all the executables, all the test environment, all, everything but the raw hardware if you have a hardware sensor sitting at the end of it. So that pattern used to be stuck in a database. This is the old school provenance, which is CMDB, it's like sold by a computer associate. So one thing we might need to transform as ontologists is we don't want to have this kind of approach. So you end up having to integrate some of this knowledge. But if we want to say the new IoT configuration management database needs to create device knowledge in a more practical and thorough way using ontology frameworks instead of the relational model, which is this basically an ERD diagram. Now, I understand these things are somewhat interoperable, but we really want to have the developers look at a different way of going about writing code, and this wouldn't be it. So I touched on the velocity thing. I'm now looking at slide 21, which is a presentation from Microsoft about their big data environment. So this is the way Microsoft pitches Azure to its people who want to run big data. So, and they have one of the more interesting big data cloud settings where you might want to put IoT. And this is, if you can't see the slide, on the leftmost side of this diagram are the sensors. And then in the next box, you see collection, and then event queuing, then transformation, then long-term storage, and then presentation. This is kind of typical developer model for how things work. But it's somewhat useful in that there's some things that aren't on it, like where's the ontology for it? Is the ontology in any one of these boxes, or is it across all of them? If there's a standard, which standard, do the standards only apply in the leftmost box, or what do you do with smart transducers or analytics cells? So obviously Microsoft wasn't intended for this. This diagram wasn't intended for this audience, but it calls into question, I think, what our role ought to be and what we would come back to say, Microsoft, you can still offer this kind of framework, but you need some other kind of infrastructure to deliver ontology capabilities. I think we covered the I'm looking at slide 22. I think we covered the provenance relevance. I think this is maybe one of the high points of our usefulness in this space is the Provo work. This is not new work, and it's not work done by this community, but it's a very strong example of where to use an ontology that we're looking at this in the big data space in the NIST Big Data Public Working Group as one of the solutions for a security fabric. Not really because it's brilliant or anything. It's just a workmanlike implementation of an ontology that's extendable. And so we just get a lot of side effects by using that discipline. I think one of the things that's going to drive adoption of the standards is trying to press new sensor implementations to be stream ready. So if you take any given sensor that's out there and then ask yourself, what if this thing had to be streaming data into Spark or Storm, what would you do it and how would you change the architecture of the stack in order to do that? And sometimes that means a change to the ontology because now you've got time issues where you didn't have them. You have to reason about time. You have to reason about aggregating. You may have to reason about intermediate analytics and what to do with that. So last year, I remember there was a talk, and we were all reminded that the measurement problems we think are so easy are not so easy, and that needs to be baked into this somehow. That when we say that things are imprecise, we have to be precise about what is not known about that. So that's from last year's talk, really. So analytics as a service. Going back to slide 23 here. Analytics as a service is actually sold as a notion. I think it's a useful reminder that you could argue that the processing modules that are stuck on a UAV could be thought of as an analytics as a service, could be a piece of firmware even in there. And that as one of the overall system of IoT needs to be considered. Now, whether the ontology should be baked into this or treated as a distributed computing phenomenon like we would have before IoT came to the fore, is an open question, but I don't think we fully address this. The standards don't directly address what to do with the analytic side of it. I'm skipping ahead a few slides here for those of you on the virtual. So I'm going to slide 29, and this is, I don't know if you caught my title slide with some provocative use cases. So the provocative use case here is about weather. So as human beings, we sort of process information about the weather without thinking about it too much, especially if we're in the Northeast and we have unpredictable weather patterns, less so in Arizona at this point. But one of the things that happens with information systems is that we try to do reasoning about data that's been gathered from sensors, and we don't look at data that's not useful or is coming to us in formats that we can't use. A guy I used to do coding with called this the impedance problem. I think that's kind of a misnomer, but the impedance problem with the National Weather Service, as I know about it anyway, is that the National Weather Service collects data from airports primarily and, you know, selected regions nearby airports. But if you're at any given point in time at a physical location, that's not necessarily the weather information that's going to come to you. And not only that, the Weather Service only posts data, and I think it's hourly or every couple hours, depending on the time of day or season. But it could be the most relevant thing to happen. So if the collapse of a building is due to snow, excessive snow on the roof, and you've got all these sensor systems, you might fail to detect that. In other words, the sensors are going to tell you things, but they won't tell you maybe the key piece of information that would be allow you to correlate this. So, yeah, this is a CEP standard problem, but it's also one of integrating data streams. So where does ontology fit into this? And I think the other talks really address that more than our work in this track. This is not a new problem. I worked on multi-sensor correlation. This is what DOD called this in the 80s. It's the same. It's really the same set of problems we're still wrestling with. Oh, I didn't want to skip by this. So a similar problem comes about in the interdependency of sensor networks. Usually it's power, but it could also be like if you lose part of a building due to a collapse, staying with that model. The cause for interruptions in sensor data could be due to the building collapse. So now you lose power to that part of the building. That means you lose some of the sensors. But fusing that information together in a sensible way probably cannot be done from the bottom up looking at just the sensors. You're going to need to have meta knowledge. So when we're arguing with the developers who don't want to do ontologies, you need to bring use cases to them that look at things at this level of abstraction, because otherwise they are not going to see the value of the investment and extra time. Yeah, I think I posed the question on this slide, this is slide 30, whether simple questions like power outages and loss signals can create on-ramps for larger projects or ontologies. So maybe that's the way to get your foot in the door. This is a slide from before we started the track, and we still don't know which of the standards are going to win out. I think if you Google IoT standards today, you're going to see the same set of questions from the New York Times and Information Week, and probably not from our community, but other people still trying to puzzle out whether Zigbee, and there's a whole list of standards that they want to know are going to prevail. And there's different commercial organizations that are lined up with different consortia, and they're competing to get standards. Well, this is a familiar trend in IT, not new. But we didn't solve that here. The people who are going to, you know, try to use ontologies with this are going to have to do battle with the standards process. And so it's part of the mainstreaming of IoT to follow the standards battle. And I'm jumping ahead to slide 34. This is another use case from elementary. So what happened in this episode, this was a couple weeks ago, the use case here is taxis driving around the cities, and he's trying to correlate events happening elsewhere in buildings to what was going on and where the taxis were. So it's a geolocation fusion with some other information. And what's interesting about this is if you watch the show and you don't have your professional ontology hat on,
you think, oh yeah, this is perfectly sensible. But if you think about it, we're nowhere near doing this. This stuff you could make into like this is at this point in time anyway completely unrealistic. And it's not a big data problem yet. It's doing this in New York City and back. Sorry about that, folks. Doing this in New York City is not a big data problem, and there are sensors there, but we can't make the kind of inferences from them that the show assumes are possible, even though the public assumes that it is. And most of these have to do with time base and synchronizing streams from multiple sources. This is slide 35. We did touch on a couple of papers presented on how to correlate events happening in different event frameworks. This is probably going to be standard looking across device types in IoT. I'm not sure whether CEP is the answer for that, but it's the one that I've worked in. It seems like it's a good one to start with. Also, there's some commercial uptake in the CEP model with folks like, not Tivoli, it's, can't think of the company name right now, but some of the business intelligence folks have adopted this model for other purposes that's been repurposed for that. So that's maybe a plus. It's not a standard, though. It's like a de facto commercial adoption. Another ontology task is going to be connecting static data coming from GPSs to streams, especially video data. So I think we touched on that. There's some known solutions that were in previous talks here, but this is, I think, going to be a design pattern that we're going to revisit. And then another thing that we didn't touch on is sort of the recreation problem or the test environment. So if you think about what for IoT is, you know, how do we leverage all this new high-resolution graphics that we have and, you know, all the on-demand visualization capabilities that exist? We should be able to use this to simulate before we build IoT systems. We should be able to use them to test, figure out if they're working right for resilience and for, you know, appropriateness and usability and how they might interact with other systems and for performance testing and tuning and audit and forensics. These are all things that we should be able to bake in now with the tool sets that are available outside of ontology. But I think if you are implementing ontologies, you're further along the road of being able to do that than if you don't use them. So it's not an example that we covered in this. It maybe is important because it was omitted in the conversation. This is an old slide. I'm looking at slide 36. Those of you trying to decide what kind of standards to adopt might want to look at this. At least you know what arenas you should be looking in. So just to pick a couple of these things out of the slide, there's product user groups. There's what a big corporate user might want to see what Cisco's decided to do or what Intel's decided to do. You might look at professional organizations. So if you're a clinician and you work in ambulatory care, you might want to go look at an ambulatory care professional group and see what they think is the standard you ought to adopt. If you're a service provider, like an IaaS or infrastructure as a service provider, you probably should go there because they're going to have standards for that. Then there's standards committees, like what NIST and industrial organizations are after. So, and the manufacturers themselves that make the sensor devices are in the driver's seat for some of this. So this landscape is still going to be there. It's all part of the mess of going after this. There's nothing new that we've learned about this, but at least you know who you're talking to. I'm on slide 39 now, jumping ahead a couple of slides. So I recap some of the related threads that you could argue are not standards but are relevant thought processes, threads in software engineering, approaches that have been taken to related problems. So that includes things like the process specification language. You can tell I'm kind of keen on that one because I had worked on that before I saw Michael's presentation. The constrained application protocol has been used in some emergency warning systems that I've seen discussed. We touched CEP. We've touched on intelligent agent work. DSL probably is worth a whole day-long conversation again somewhere, how to marry DSLs with ontologies for IoT. And DoD, because they've been working at this longer, I think there's probably old abandoned projects that DoD has sponsored in the past that are relevant to this work.
composable services is what they used to call this, I think, in the mid-2000s. Going back before then, it was called other things. But a lot of it, you know, the battlefield intelligence situation awareness problem is so similar to this in many ways that it would be impossible to not find some useful work in there. It probably is not code. It's probably patterns for how to approach the sensor problem and the problem of rolling up data, because like one of the primary use cases for that is you have sensors in the field and you have what they call forward observer reports, which is a person saying something about an event they observe on the field. And how do you correlate those two things? So that's an old problem that goes to the early 80s or maybe before that. It's still hard. It's a great use case to tackle with an ontology suite. So these are some of the, I'm going to wrap this up shortly. These are some of the IoT event processes that that Miller's XMPP protocol addresses. They have to deal with error recovery and correction. I'm not convinced from having seen his presentation that they're using any ontology-based solution to tackle that. What about a decision framework? Is there one? Is the decision framework an ad hoc piece of code implemented by every developer? Kind of looks like that to me. Think about it. What is the decision in a computer program for a big application, even for something like SAP? These are monolithic coding projects developed over, you know, 50 to 100 man years per module. And if you ask yourself, well, where is the decision process in there, it's lost. It's buried in some layer that a specialist could find faster than I could, but it's not pulled out in an abstraction that could be used to hook a device to. And hooking a device to is one of the main use cases for this is, wow, I have SAP. I want to have put these sensors on the shop floor so I can tell when one of my machines is vibrating too much, and I can get an alert back to the guy who's the foreman. Believe me, it would take you weeks to get to the piece of code in SAP that would give you a hook to do that. And that's a mature framework. That's somebody who's worried about how to do the abstractions and who has the money to do it. Skipping to slide 42. Something else we haven't talked about is what ACM in their taxonomy of software calls information-centric networking. I think if you think of, going back to Ram's idea that the Internet of Things is more than just things, it's about people and networks of people and systems. The link here to ACM's way of looking at this encompasses more than just things. And if you think of the things as networks, and other network representations like the named network approach that might be looking at, might be worth looking at. And maybe even SDN has got some relevance here. And that's the standard in the work. The standards work being done on that is something we did not look at here either. There is a use case for that I managed to find for cyber physical systems. I think I credit this somewhere, but I don't see what it is right now. But the link, hopefully the link will tell you where that's from. That's on slide 43. On slide 44, some of the cross-cutting concerns. This is not a new slide, so if you've seen my talk before, this is all the same. On slide 45, I recap what I think are some of the design patterns and credit some of the people who in other talks have addressed them. This was not stuff from our track, but from other tracks. On slide 46, there's some lessons learned from the SSN ontology, which is maybe the most mature IoT ontology. One of them is that standard to standard and model to model translations are still to be determined, how to approach that. That maybe is an area where ontologists could operate and help people. Steve Ray calls those model refactorings. Whatever you call it, it's an ongoing problem. It's one that enterprises recognize that developers do not. The case of CPOP, which is the command post of the future, this came up in one of our sessions. That's an interesting sensor platform with a lot of experimentation that was done around it. It actually got deployed and used. There's pros and cons with the stack that was developed to do that, but it's an interesting mature platform to look at. I'm putting a plug for our past summit. It's had a lot of information to be mind there. And slide 47 is, I'm going to stop in 2 minutes, is a reminder that the proximity to the edge, literally or figuratively or abstractly, is one of the design principles that was talked about by a number of the people, but is baked into the universal identifier in the Miller standard that he presented for us. That notion, and I think it was underlying that approach to try to use the IPv6 model as well, that everything should have these universal unique identifiers. And so the question we might have to ask is, well, are we talking about taxonomies or identifications? How do you map between these two things? And if that's not what they mean, what do they mean? Is it some other abstraction that we've covered here? I also get the feeling, those of us who have been around more than 20 years, that we're rehashing stuff from the distributed computing literature. And so I always am going back to IEEE Explorer and the ACM computing library and looking up stuff to see. I'm sure this was in there before. Because a lot of these problems are really new, whether it was in RPCs or, you know, other approaches. The fact that the internet was not what it is today in those doesn't mean they weren't worried about the same problems. So similar conceptual frameworks were out there. And so the design patterns might have been developed in those frameworks as well. So probably worth revisiting that. This slide 48 is on security and privacy. I think we've covered this already, but I think ontology might be one of the places where we have something to contribute on the security side. What we're doing in the big data, the just big data public working group, is trying to put a security fabric over the notion of this, and you might try to do this for IoT as well. Slide 49 is the latest version of the list of standards. It's probably not complete. I invite all of you on the call to email me so I can update this, because I think this would be a handy thing for us to have on the wiki. Here's a list of some of the groups that are producing the standards. Not all of these, you can see, are directly related to IoT. For example, I put BPMN up there because that's how you get the people into the system. That's one of the approaches, is you take the workflow standards and you try to map the workflow standards onto the things standards, and that way you get the people involved. It's a way of mapping the risk framework. And then I reprieved some of the questions we worked on in the second session. We had basically an open forum where I threw out questions to our smart panelists and said, how would you do this? So I invite you to take a look at the thread. We saved the chat logs from that conversation. These are some of the questions from that, which I included in the deck. We won't go over them at this point. And that was it.
Thank you, Mark. We have time for some questions. Gary?
Yes, this is Gary Burkross. So I had a comment on this big topic of context, and midway through the presentation, I think you had a couple of questions, and I was ready to respond to the questions if they were really meant for it. But one question you had there was problem with sensors, such as snow on the roof and not being able to derive the right type of thing. Well, from my perspective, what's involved there, or moving towards a solution there, is that there are probably other agents within the network that are responsible for setting the context, the situation. So if you have a weather forecast in terms of weather, or you have maybe wind for trees coming down that might have a power alert and so forth, so you would have, in a fully functioning IoT, you would have this setting, which would then alert sensors within a neighborhood where there's warnings for whatever it is, that would, at that, in that context, and then they would be trying to reach a conclusion in terms of a warning and things of that nature. So I can see it within some of the approaches we talked about really working. If you think about the IoT as being a complex network where there are interacting agents, some of them are responsible for some smarts that then would inform other agents or sensors to do the right thing or forward their data in a certain sense to reach a conclusion.
Right, I hear you. So but I want to redirect the question back to you, though, because what I want to be able to do is to take the developer by the scruff of the neck to some framework that forces him to confront the ubiquity of these other sources of data that may be out there. In other words, exercise the landscape of all the contexts that he might have to consider, that there's some systematic way of visiting those, not because his answer was to that would be, well, I'll just build an agent for it. Or you didn't tell me I had to do weather. Okay, I'll do weather.
Yeah, well, it gets back to something, for example, Mike raised the question about competency for the ontology, the things that interest. So it's a general requirement setting. So when you're building these systems, the question is, what's the scope of the requirements that you're trying to handle? So if you have some scenarios in terms of the things I talked about, in terms of heavy snowfall that might damage roofs or bring down power lines, then within that context, there's a system of agents that you need as opposed to just the sensors for heavy snow on the roof. So it comes back to the question of what was the situation for the developers and what was their understanding of requirements at that time? And what's your process also? So some of the things you were talking about in terms of standards are not just the data standards or ontology standards. It's best practice standards in a sense. How do you go about, what's the methods for going about doing this right? Right. And so some of that is to sort of make sure that you have contextual settings for the development itself.
So I don't want to belabor this because there are probably other questions, but this is too important to let go by. What I don't want to have happen is for them, for the developer who's now really unhappy that I'm still holding onto the scruff of his neck, to say, well, that's the requirements problem. The analyst failed to give me the requirements. Because the ontology, what we would think is the ontology brings with the framework a way of exercising all these other relevant things in the context. That it's not just a matter of collecting requirements in sort of an old school. You know what I'm saying?
I need Todd? To continue on this point, or I might explode here. I'm confused because many of the, during your talk, you attributed to ontology a capability that sounded more like effectively something out of its scope, because the ontology itself has to be scoped. And in order to do that, you have to know the context, the situation, the scenarios, and the use cases. Now, if you want to take some junior developer who has failed to have a larger life experience and cannot imagine all sorts of various scenarios, then you're going to be screwed one way or another. But, again, I still didn't understand how you could attribute to the development of ontology many of those things which you have to do for any development project, independent of ontology, software. I mean, if you're building a building, you have to go out and do a site survey. You have to do all the environmental impacts, blah, 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 traffic studies, whatever. So if you could clarify that confusion for me, I'd be appreciative.
I'm going to fail at that. It's part of the problem that there's a scope fail about that. But let me answer it this way by saying, if I'm building a device and I don't give the device a model that is independent of measurements of like the bandwidth of what temperatures it can send and the bit rate that it comes out of and how it gets powered on and off. And if you look at what's in the protocol standard for William Miller's group, right, if that's all you get from that, there's no way to map from that to a thing that says you need to know something about weather. So unless you bring an ontology framework that is bigger than the model into the picture, the ontology does some of the work of that. It doesn't get you all the way there. It still maybe explodes the scope too much and you have to reduce it. But the developer thinks he's done. See, if I'm the guy building the sensor device, I think my work is done. Once I've written the code to send the data stream out, and I've got a product data sheet you can download the PDF for, I'm done. Somebody else can write the model.
So I was thinking very much along the same lines as what Todd expressed in detail about this. I was thinking in terms of iterative development. That includes the iterative development of ontologies. And one way of doing that is to make sure you're telling your developers, look, this is a module approach. I want you to build in connections to other things that are going to be out there. We've identified certain types of things in the Internet of Things, such as controllers and situation assessors and so forth. That's going to set some context for your agent. We're going to have to be able to adapt this based on our experience as these things get put out in the environment. So be prepared. So it just you're developing something. You have a limited model, but it's also extensible and modular. So I think we need to adapt our approaches as we do this.
I don't disagree.
Well, actually, that might bring up another issue with regard to the use of ontologies. If you use ontologies fairly somewhat intelligently, you have a built-in extensible capability.
Well, I'm trying to argue that, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, this community understands that, but my belief is that 99% of all code written doesn't. There's no ontology in most of the code written today. There's no curriculum that says when you write a piece of code, you have to have an ontology construct of any kind.
Oh, be careful there. We need to distinguish between an explicit ontology and an implicit ontology. Anyone that's going to be writing code brings along with them their life experiences, which to some extent is an ontology. And they are most likely imbuing the code that they're writing with or constraining the code they're writing with that knowledge. So that it's there, but it's not explicit.
Well, it's not intersubjective in the same way that you would have with the civil engineering model. So you don't have the two architects looking at the same piece of code coming up with the same model because there's no standard for doing it. If you don't have, if it's not AL or RDF or some other standard that's out there, how do you get it out of his class library? That's what you're looking at, is a class library. You're going to get it from the person's naming conventions in the class library.
Maybe.
If you're lucky.
Joe?
This is Chip. Yeah, I have just a couple comments on a different track. So, you know, Mark mentioned at one point information-centric networking and named data networking. I think they're super relevant to Internet of Things because ultimately they're about dealing with the scale of things on available on the Internet. And both of those are about locating and addressing just vast quantities of data objects that are already available and increasingly so. I would actually say that those are a paradigm that is actually different from previous networking work. So that is actually something that is, you know, the fundamental model is totally different from traditional internet stack networking. And the work that, you know, I have been presenting talk about the summit is very much about how to apply ontologies to that in ontologies explicitly, right? So when they talk about named data networking, their names are super simple for the most part, right? It's some of the most expressive schemes are basically just hierarchical strings that traverse down maybe some topic tree, that kind of thing, to indicate, you know, a piece of content. And that becomes very, very limited very fast. So our kind of work is about, well, what if you actually can ride much more powerful semantic web style reasoning over those kinds of systems? The software-defined networking is actually a super fascinating area, and there's actually a substantial branch within that that is based around logic programming of the host. And it's interesting to me where, you know, this is one of several kinds of examples where, you know, I look at it and they're doing all these things that, you know, doing a lot of declarative reasoning and all this kind of stuff, but none of them would think of it in terms of ontologies. You know, one of the key people in that area is actually one of my co-advisors in school, and it took a long time for us to be on the same page in terms of, you know, talking about ontologies and explicit knowledge representation, even as he was, you know, doing all this declarative reasoning. And the final point is, you know, early on, Mark was talking about, you know, all these different standards for Internet of Things and how they're connected, like ZigBee, Z-Wave, all these kinds of different protocols and so on. So some of the work that we've been doing for our company has basically been writing user and administration apps for a company building an IoT platform that has in turn been sold and retailed by to Fortune 500 companies, and the basis of that platform is basically integrating a lot of these different protocols, and it is an absolute disaster underneath. So basically there's almost no abstraction in front of those things, right? So a Z-Wave light is totally different from a Still Q light in terms of the data objects that you send and receive from them, even though ultimately they're just lights, right? That's in some ways a really basic model to work out, and I'm sure there are things like the semantic sensor network ontology that probably have concepts related to that, but there's just that's so far removed from what any of these people developing a lot of these kind of systems are thinking about in terms of how they approach these problems. And so, you know, I talked with a couple of people today about basically the huge gulf between, you know, all of us here as ontology people and people doing basically industrial Internet of Things, you know, like this product, but you can go down to Best Buy and buy it. And it's doing a lot of things where ontologies would actually make it better. That's not even remotely on the radar in terms of how to go about implementing those systems, right? And then there's a whole other huge gulf to the very energetic hobby Internet of Things industry, right? And just a whole other set of basically approaches and mindsets to what's going on. So I think that's something that should be thought about a lot in terms of, you know, impact of the summit and so on. There's definitely problems to be solved, but there are huge, you know, barriers to cross, both in terms of getting attention and then, you know, speaking the same language and having people understanding what you're talking about and selling it.
Ravi, you had your hand raised.
Am I off the mute now?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Two threads. One to think about, namely, if we keep track of time, that is time series sense, if we keep track of sessions, as in software or web session sense, do we reach a reasonable awareness or context definition? And are there patterns in your thinking or ontology thinking that would address this use case? In that case, the measurement information can be more intelligent. So if software keeps track of sessions and time, it becomes more intelligent, becomes more aware, and is able to respond to a context. That was the first question.
Probably I'm not the one to answer this, but I'll take this from the little piece of this problem that I know about, which is the web state sessions. That's
yes.
Since the beginning of the internet, so now, you know, there's stateless ways of managing sessions. Some, you know, lightly loaded servers, you know, don't terminate sessions. The logical session for a login and a log off may be not connected to the session state that's saved in the web server. So I'm not sure that the solution you just described to me sounds like a programmatic, not an ontological solution. So it's workable, but it's probably a little suspicious in that it might not endure over another generation or two of web applications.
Okay. The second is burdening a particular sensor or a set of very small specific domain sensors with the human cognition type of responsibility, like a building is cracking or noise too much, so it's vibrating. You have to have some understanding of how one sensor, which is meant to measure temperature, can give you something about the stress on the building. So these are, you know, context this has to be done in a very intelligent way. You don't expect a temperature sensor to tell you that the building is fogging. That's all.
Point taken.
I would give another example of some of these things that sensors might not, a regular sensor might not tell you. So you can measure temperature. If you're measuring the temperature of a patient, is it increasing or decreasing? Is it in the high category as opposed to just a simple measurement? There's all kinds of health contexts within which a specific sensor might not give you that, but we can imagine in which they would because they're informed by what healthcare practitioners really need to know about the temperature.
Yeah, these are pretty large value spaces, you know, and there may be ideals, there may be minimums, maximums, and it could vary depending upon, let's say, the particular patient, right? So
yeah, but babies' high temperatures are different than adults. And
yep.
Can I have
Ready.
A question next?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, this chart is this is Ram here again. Standards, I guess, the key thing. So if you look at the whole Internet of Things, look at standards, they come at several places. making census by the way, there's an issue of this. As Jeff Rose gave this talk about different kinds of sensors and you know, all kinds of things in there. There's also one of the important things from the NIST perspective is measurement aspects of it. I mean, there's the measurements of the sensors and there's the uncertainty associated with the measurement. So if the temperature sensor is giving a piece of, let's say it's 25 degrees centigrade. It's actually, there is an uncertainty associated with this particular sensor around that that needs to be taken into account. The other thing is that as you keep going higher and higher, then now you get one more level, you're combining the sensors together and you're forming higher level of abstractions into the thing. And then these physical sensors now enters into the social world, so you have the notion of a social sensor because there are people, they're talking together, there's some patterns out there. Now how do you represent those sensors and what are your measurement criteria, what are the standards out there? The other thing to do with the notion of standards, I think, I don't know whether it was discussed or not, I'm sorry, I missed a few things, is that what are the current gaps? What are the standards out there that have been discussed? What are the gaps to get there? How do you get out there? What kinds of standards are required out there? And I presume you discussed that. I'm not sure, but just leave it on the floor here.
Michael?
Well, so then where do we think we could have the most impact? Would it be in providing IoT standards with ontologies, or is it looking at the problems themselves and saying, let's start building ontologies to help the real applications kind of, may not do an end run around the standards, but.
End run around the thing.
Well, no, kind of looking at the problems themselves and saying what ontologies do people need to use to help build these applications? Or do we have a better impact on actually helping people use the standards that already exist?
Joe?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of my immediate thoughts on that is ontologies, in some sense, by themselves don't do anything, right? So, I mean, they help people understand, define standards better, all that kind of thing. But I would guess that the vast majority of this domain is essentially looking for actionable tools, right? If it doesn't help them with some application, it's not relevant, right? So I would tend to believe it's less about yet more standards or embellishing standards or so on, more in terms of showing, you know, applied computational uses of ontologies in KR.
Right. And that's what I meant by the end run, I guess. I mean,
Michael,
make it work.
I'm supporting it. Just the way you described it, however, I can imagine a combination of this. So if you start with the idea that we recognize that there are gaps, there are problems people are trying to solve out there, one thing they may not know is what relevant ontologies exist. But given the state of the world, they're probably not designed for those particular problems, but are relevant. So what we have to do is sort of say, okay, here's a start. And part of this may make sense to you. Does that make sense to you? This part I don't think makes sense to you. Am I correct? Okay, then we need to modify that and bridge it, and we need to connect it to this X thing. And by the way, we need to modify that too. So I think making sure it's relevant to the people in the domain and their problems they're interested in, and having the expertise to say what we know of where we are and where we need to go, that's the way to do it.
Michael, what problem did you want to solve with the standard or standards?
Well, I didn't have a problem in mind, but just like as Ron was saying, that with this track was looking at the synergy between standards and emerging IT standards and ontologies, and I was just kind of thinking, in some ways, when you say there's a certain standard around, say the wireless, 802.11 protocol for Wi-Fi, right? Well, when you put that standard there, then people can start building applications that use Wi-Fi, and so. You could say, well, that's how we can make an impact on ontologies is take some emerging IoT standard and augment it with ontologies, and that can enable new things. As opposed to kind of like telling people, just use ontologies. Like Harry said, that's not going to do anything. But if you can kind of say, oh, well, you're already using the standard, you can augment it with this ontology and do something more. Right? Should we do that? Or should it just be, here's this problem you're trying to solve, help build ontologies to help them?
If standards are usually devised to solve a problem or to provide consensus so people can solve problems or a range of problems and produce products, right? So,
actually, in terms of standards, there are several. Tomorrow, I think the panel is going to discuss that in a little more detail. So I'm going to defer to that. but there are a lot of issues with standards. There are different kinds of standards. There is de facto standards also which evolve. Some of the standards, like Internet Industry Internet Consortium, their standard may become a default standard, default de facto standard. Who knows, okay? Like, just like Microsoft Word has become at this stage to a certain extent. Not really, but to a certain extent, yes. But I think the key thing around here is that whatever you like or not, you like it or not, we need standards, okay? Otherwise, I'll be out of job. Here is what, I'm going to make a bold claim here that which actually I kind of put it in, we wrote a paper about 15 years ago or so on, that standards actually lead to innovation. Okay, and yeah, when they are incorporated at the right time. So in other words, if assuming that an ontology has become a part of the standards framework, and I believe that in the future that they're going to be, you have going to have some innovative ways of doing IoT.
This is Gary again. So my experience in working with a number of domain people on to build ontologies is that you get several types of domain experts. One type immediately goes to standards and says, these are the relevant standards. Then another person might be in there and said, yes, I've used those standards and they don't fully satisfy what I need. And so the standards are a place to start from, but they aren't necessarily where all you need to do. You often need to modify that. And ontology work often tells you how, you know, the deficiencies there and what you need to add.
Again, let me give you an example here. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the HL7 standard for healthcare and the meaningful, I mean, it's actually becoming a standard, whether you like it or not. That's the standard that people are going to use in the future to do interoperability. But for those of you who have not read Barry Smith's blog on that, I mean, you should read the blog really. Okay? I mean, it's not, you may not agree with it, but I recommend that you read it.
It's a diatribe.
He has some very, very important points in there. Now, imagine a world in the future that all interoperability is based on HL7 and assume that, just a thought experiment, and let us say for the time being that Barry Smith is totally right and look at what will happen in the future, okay? So this is a thought experiment for tonight.
I think the Barry's criticism is one of the reasons you have that circled theory that Mark has highlighted, where they talk about explicitly about adding semantics to it.
Michael, you have two people on.
Who do we have?
David and then
Robbie. David first and then Robbie. Online.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, thanks, Robbie. Sorry, I have to go first, I guess. It's actually on HL7. We had a discussion back in July or August about this very thing, and one of the competing standards, I forget what it is, we were actually discussing the clinical document architecture, and this competing standard actually has a UML like defined ontology, but it only supplies the definition, no workable system based off of it. And to me, this almost seems useless. You have software, you've defined what the information means, but you've not produced a tool that does anything out of it. And that seems to be one of the largest problems we were running into, and it was sort of touched on in the last talk, where you have ontologies upon ontologies and standards upon standards, but all it is information that on its own doesn't do anything, and it's very difficult to make workable systems off of that. Just a point of observation I've seen from my own work experience.
And Robbie, I guess?
Yes.
I am typing in the chat also the thought process. One is telescoping standards make sense as long as they follow. Like in ontologies, we have a notion of upper ontology and domain ontology. Similarly, in healthcare standards, there are problems trying to interoperate from one standard to another. If things happen too fast, the return on investment is not good. If they become too slow, then people get locked into old technologies and don't innovate. So for ICD-10, HL7, HIPAA, and this MITRE compliance of architecture, etc., and funding based on these things, they are hurting the healthcare industry. Also helping, it modernized. So both ways. Thank you.
I think we can open up the discussion to more general question and answer issues that have been raised so far today. So not necessarily Mark and his track, but all the tracks and any other comments by our speakers and so forth.
Just a logistic issue. We actually moved the dinner to 6 o'clock at the front page, same as last year. If you're interested in joining us, we have reserved for about 15 folks. I'm not sure how many of you will be coming. At least 10, I'm sure. Okay, so that you can leave around 8 o'clock or so. Yeah. Because tomorrow we have to come here, come back here early morning. Try to come early morning here tomorrow, because now tomorrow the coffee will be ready by the time you come in. There's breakfast there, bagels. There's a lot of things out there you got to get. You have to finish it. Okay, so that's for tomorrow. And anything else in terms of logistics? I think that's about it. Time. Yeah. So whenever we can leave, we can stay here as long as we want. They said someone will come and close it. But unless someone wants to leave here by 5:30 and go down, it's left to you. So we have time. Pardon? I don't know. They probably have something. There may be a beer place around here, all kinds of things. So you can find here. You can stop now and come back tomorrow. So it's left to you. Again, I know people are tired. It's been a long day. I mean, I woke up at 4 today. 4:30, yeah.
Can you downstairs?
Yeah, downstairs if you want to. So, you want to officially bring this to an end in a few minutes, or what do you want to do? It depends
on
the concept.
Unless there's any other pressing issues that, can't be discussed.
Now we would like to ask the co-chairs for this.
One more question. And
yeah.
It's directed to Joe. Joe, if I heard you, I think I heard you suggest that data could be a thing in the concept of Internet of Things. Did I mishear you or misunderstood you? Understand you?
Yeah, that is basically what I was saying. I would be, I would want to probably think about it and be more careful in speaking to those communities in that way. But I personally think that is kind of a valid way to think about it. So I don't know how familiar you or anybody is, like information-centric networking and so on. But the key idea is basically that individual data objects themselves are addressable, right? So instead of, say to download the slides, you go to the SIM3, your web browser goes to the SIM3 server, sends it a message, and gets slides from that server, right? So in traditional internet stack, the endpoint is a fundamental primary addressable entity, right? You're sending a message to this server or client, and it's taking an action. Whereas an ICN, NDN, all these kind of things, information-centric network kind of subsuming a number of different approaches, the data itself is addressable, and where you get it from is irrelevant, right? So you say, I want this slide block, which is identified in some way, whether it's a unique hash of the bytes, is most typical or whatever, and whoever has that serves it up to you, right? So then the protocol is trying to find the closest thing, and that's all to enable, lots of opportunistic caching, right? So if I forward packets all the way through to you to exchange those slides, and then somebody else here asks for them, they don't have to go all the way back to me, because in this case, they've already got them, right? To me, that is basically making each data object a thing in some sense. It's not an active thing, right? It can't send traffic, doesn't generate traffic or receive it, but it is and it vastly expands the number of endpoints on the internet, right? And creates a ton of addressing and discovery and all these kind of problems that all overlap greatly with Internet of Things problems.
We can even think of this a bit more broadly in terms of intelligent agents producing judgments or recommendations and things of that nature. They get interrogated, a whole series of them. So what is this cluster think is going to happen to this area with the weather? What does that cluster think and so forth? And so, essentially it's what equivalent to what people are generating judgments and decisions is really information that they're providing.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. Internet of Things is kind of by definition all about physical things,
But really, all the same ideas apply to software agents. Right? It doesn't really matter if it's a button or an agent sitting there doing something.
Well, I guess that was my question. Is it the general consensus that the Internet of Things are these physical things as opposed to information-bearing entities? Or excluding them?
I think Internet of Things as a physical thing is the definitely the meaning of that specific phrase. Right? Like, it, yeah, I mean, it is Internet of Things. Like, the whole point is that they are actual things, not cyber entities.
Depends how you interpret things.
Well, but I'm saying, like, that is how that meaning is being prescribed. And basically what I am saying is that despite that being the meaning of it, the concepts that actually achieve it are more generally applicable.
Okay. Maybe we've reached the end here today. I'm going to carry on the conversation.
We give it to the general coaches to close the session.
Okay, sure.
Officially.
Well, I was just intrigued by Mark's comments about getting case studies from TV shows. So there was the episode of Elementary, you said, so I looked that one up. What else should I watch on Hulu next night?
Try a 1954 version of Dragnet, where they use punch cards in the computer to figure out which car was the getaway.
Has anyone seen Cyber's DSI?
Oh, okay, so that's...
Yeah,
no, that's a non-starter.
Well, no, I mean, seriously, like you said about that one episode of Elementary, and using it as a use case, just in the sense of actually communicating with other people. Like, that's something that kind of resonates with me sometimes when you're talking, you raise that sort of an example. So you think of any others, most of them might be interested in using those as ways of kind of pop platforms.
So we're using the Internet to generate use cases for Internet of Things.
Okay, so that's it for today, then. We'll see everybody tomorrow morning. And we'll be starting off with a keynote, followed by the presentation of the community phase, and then the demos and final presentation.